brothers, sisters, working class heroes, this is the Rich Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Oh, so much to get to, so much to talk about. The attack on workers continues thanks to the Koch brothers. Lots of money pouring in from across the globe to make sure that our workers don't have the right to organize or to collectively bargain. Yes, yes, mission accomplished, Koch brother extremists. Also, Privatization Nation, more of the ALEC model, more of the hooray for them, not much for you and me. Well, we're going to talk about privatization. And also, you know, should we just be building our own infrastructure as past generations have done? I mean, just a thought. Just throw that out there. If it's in the good, in the best interest of our society, of we the people, shouldn't we the people be doing it without a profit motive? Just a thought. We're going to talk about that. Also, the minimum wage. I'm happy to finally see that we're talking about rewarding work. And I go back to the day President Obama took office. The one thing that I wished for him is that he would be the guy who would return reward to work. That if you work for a living, and this is a frame that I know is you know, our grandparents' era, but it still makes sense to me that if you get up and you go to work every day and you're invested in what you're doing, you should not go hungry. You should not be homeless. You should not be without. And, you know, as we're talking about the last few days, this idea of where are we going into the future as we see jobs being mechanized, as we see computers doing more and more, as we're seeing productivity skyrocketing and the wealth from that productivity being put into the hands of the very few. What about everyone else? What does that look like for society? Now, look, I understand the old frame. I get the old frame that, well, you know, you work hard, you should be able to keep it all. I don't think it's going to work in the future. And I think at some point, we end up saying enough is enough. And you see another. I go back to, you know, a couple callers I had, you know, a while ago talking about the French Revolution and, you know, the peasants, you know, basically taking to the castle door. Is that what it's going to take? Sure hope not. But lots to get to. Also, the Volkswagen election for representation going on. I guess it's going to start tomorrow. We'll run Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And the wealth class of this country losing their minds. The fact that a corporation would say, you know, we don't care. You want to be represented by workers? Fine. Works for us everywhere else around the world. Why can't it work here? Wealth class going nuts. So I'd be interested in your thoughts, your questions, your comments, whatever's on the plate for this evening. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. A couple of big news pieces today. A couple of things that just jump right off the page. For instance, I've been saying, hey, you know, the debt ceiling fight's coming up. Oh, boy, you know, get the boxing gloves out, square off the ring, let's get the jousting. I was waiting for a big fight. I was waiting for lots of histrionics. I was waiting for the barbs to be thrown. I was waiting for the TV sound bites and all. Nothing. Kind of boring. It's kind of like it was during the Bush years, where, you know, the debt ceiling comes up, yawn. Oh, I think I'll vote for it. Okay, go ahead. It passes, they go out, they have steak dinner. Not so much steak dinner now, but because a big storm is coming. Understand the big storm on Wednesday has got Congress kind of worried, so they're getting out of Dodge. The vote was 221 to 201. You had 28 Republicans, 28 of the 232 Republicans who voted for the bill. And look, that gives them the I wouldn't vote for it. It was those Democrats that did it. And those liberal Republicans, like there's some of those. Now, what's going to do is it's going to give an entire year. We're not going to have these fights, these battles. We're not going to have it for a year, which is going to give what the Republicans love to talk about, but don't actually understand. Going to give certainty certainty to business, certainty to our economy, certainty to the global economy that, you know, we're going to pay our bills. What a novel concept. I love that. We're going to pay our bills, man. We ran them up. We might as well pay for them. And what I always found interesting about the debt, and maybe you've got some different ideas on this, but what I've always found interesting on the fight over the debt ceiling is this is money that we'd already spent. It's already gone. It's gone. We've already consumed what it is that we purchased. Now you got to pay for it. And it's always one of those things that goes, you know, I pay my credit card every month. When the bill comes due, Rick says, all right, there's the bill. Let me write the check. Because I don't want to pay the interest. Now, I wish we could do that as a nation, but I know, I understand the bigger picture. I know the right loves to say, well, kitchen table economics. You can't run a government like kitchen table economics. There are too many moving parts. There are long views of things, like investing in infrastructure, which we'll talk about a little bit later in the program. But, you know, I guess the first part of it, the debt ceiling's off the table. No more fights over that for at least another year. I'm kind of sad. I kind of feel a little sad. What about you? I feel a little sad because, you know, I got used to every 2 or 3 months, you know, that down to the wire, the bomb is ticking. We're marching towards the cliff, and we're all going to go over into the abyss, and it's going to be the end of civilization because we have no idea what it looks like. If the United States would default, what would the world do? Would everything cease to exist? Would we all just stop in time? Would we implode? Or maybe we'd go back in time. yeah. I'm sorry. That's a little bit extreme. But you know, the reality is, you know, we've spent the money. We should pay for it. So, good. At least there was some rational thought today. Also, and you got to love this, and I guess it comes along the idea. I was thinking about Ronald Reagan today. You know, Reagan was a guy that, since it was his, I guess, was 103rd birthday the other day, a guy that the right has canonized. He is now the sainted one, which, you know, he isn't recognizable in today's Republican Party. You couldn't find a Republican like Ronald Reagan. Not that I'm idolizing, not that I'm saying he was all that great, because I think he was the beginning of the destruction of the end of the American middle class. But the party has gone so far off the beaten path that guy's not even recognizable in today's party. He couldn't get elected dog catcher, let alone ever even become close to anything near the federal government. But he used to like to quip. And, you know, the one thing I give Ronald Reagan really the ultimate credit for, he was an amazing actor in politics. Not such a good actor on film. Best at B actor at best. You know, Bonzo, you know, the Bonzo movies. Okay. A couple of the other ones, I've seen them. Not that great. But he was really good, and understand, a trained actor who was able to deliver a line. He knew where to stand, you know, and this is, you know, I guess part of that era's Hollywood actor, actress. Know where to stand, know where your spot is, know where your cue, and know how to deliver a line. And that, you know, that did well for him. He knew where to stand, and he knew when to deliver, and how to deliver, and the inflection, and he was very good at it. So he was a master at the one-liner. He really was. And he had good writers, memorized his lines well, and bang, he was right there. If you remember, there was one that he used to talk about, you know, liberals are, you know, it's not that they're ignorant. No, it's that they're just things that they know that aren't so. And, you know, I always remembered going back to that time going, well, exactly what are you talking about? Because all of the things that I remember at the time that conservatives were spewing, same kind of thing. You know, they make up their own facts. And I guess, you know, it's easy to make up your own facts and make up your own reality. But I look at some of the stuff going on, and there's part of me that says, you know, maybe we should be investigating Daryl Issa. If we're hell-bent on special investigators, if we're hell-bent on going after and investigating, Issa would be a good place to start. because a lot of insanities come out of his committee. The Benghazi thing, probably among the biggest. And you think of all of the money that they've spent, that the House Oversight Committee has spent on this, it just kind of makes you go, you know, I think we really need to take a step back and look at some of the nonsense that came out. I remember Stephen King, the representative, not the author, back in 2002. Saying that what happened in Benghazi was worse than Watergate. And he said, because in Watergate no one died, but the president, and you know, this is one of the things. You know, he was basically inferring that the president had the military stand down. And I remember him asking the question, who told the SEALs to stand down? And, you know, all of this. Now, look, it is a horrible, horrible tragedy that Ambassador Stevens and the other three were murdered. A horrible tragedy. Horrible, horrible, horrible. There is nothing in this good. Nothing good in this. And the Republicans sought to take this horrible situation and exploit it for their political gain. And I know there are a lot of people out there saying, well, you know, I heard on the radio, Benghazi, Benghazi, Benghazi. Well, a new report out today. New report put out by the House Armed Services Committee, the Republican-headed House Armed Services Committee, mind you. And they have come to the conclusion there's absolutely no way for the U.S. military to respond. They would have never gotten to Benghazi in time. Wouldn't have happened. Could not have saved those four brave, proud Americans. Couldn't have done it. And basically, it just debunks the entire right-wing myth that Obama, you know, intervened and Obama made them stand down and Obama sacrificed those four people. Ridiculous. Just completely ridiculous. And what's interesting to me is the more ridiculous the statement, the more outrageous the claim, the more some people buy it. It's worse than Watergate. It's horrible. The president made those SEALs stand down. And you go, does anybody really believe that? Because I've had conversations with people where I've just gone, do you really believe that? I mean, is that something that, you know, it's an interesting talking point. You just throw it out there. Hey, let's see what kind of rise you get out of people, what kind of reaction. But do you really believe that? And when you get people, when you really ask that question, most people go, I don't know. But what I've heard, what the right-wing media keeps throwing out. What's interesting to me, though, the report doesn't say anything about all of the money that was gutted out of the State Department's budget that would have gone to increase personnel, which would have gone to investing in making sure, well, that these kind of things don't happen. So screw Quester, all the austerity, all of the pulling back, look, I don't see any of that in here. But I guess it doesn't really matter, does it? Because when there's so much that you know that isn't so, does it really matter? Because what's going on in this country, and for way too long, we've listened to these talking heads blather on about, oh, yeah, they, blah, blah, blah. And somehow we believe the worst things about people. And I just find it very, very troubling. And as we look at the things to come, it comes down to the policies. If we want to make sure Benghazi never happens again, which I pray never does, and I know everyone else hopes never does, let's make sure that those people are adequately staffed, make sure the facilities are adequately enforced, make sure that we have the right intelligence. And I guess this comes from, you know, maybe some advice for the White House. Maybe we need to be going back to the days where we didn't say anything until we knew what was going on. In this 24-hour news cycle where we got to know instantaneously as things are going on, we don't give people the ability to say, well, you know, we now have new facts. We've now reevaluated. So I look at this tragedy, and it sickens me that it's turned into a political issue when it really should be something that's uniting us around how do we make sure it never happens again, and just something that's dividing us and again being used for the wrong aims. I mean, how many times do Republicans have to be wrong before we say, you're wrong? Curious your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I need you. And if you fall for all the crap I spew, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Right-wing anti-union Tennessee politicians are now threatening to withhold further incentives from the state for expansion of the VW Chattanooga plant if the workers there decide to join the UAW this week. The historic election will be held Wednesday through Friday. Republican State Senator Beau Watson said at a press conference that should the workers choose to go union, he believes any additional state incentives for expansion of the VW plant would have a hard time passing the Tennessee Senate. VW is neutral in this election, but outside right-wing groups are running an anti-union campaign in Chattanooga. Pro-union VW workers featured in a UAW video expressed excitement at the prospect of the VW plant going UAW. VW Chattanooga worker Justin King says that a German-style co-determination model with union-represented workers and management working together would be good for VW.
Volkswagen will be stronger when they come together with the UAW because that combines not only Volkswagen's history of working with labor, but it also adds in the UAW's experience of working in the U.S. market.
Tammy Flint can't wait to vote for the UAW.
I'm excited. I can't wait. I was in the union for 15 years in the UAW, so I know what stuff they bring to the table with them. And I think it'll be a great thing. I just can't wait for this to get started. I'm ready for it.
Ed Hunter says the UAW effort at VW has been a grassroots worker effort from the start.
It's been a grassroots effort from the beginning that we invited the UAW in to start this campaign and help us through this transition.
Tennessee Republican leaders say VW is supporting the UAW, so that's why they're threatening to withhold any future state incentives for VW expansion. VW announced in January it's investing $7 billion in the North American market over the next 5 years. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio delivered his State of the City speech on Monday. He touted policies he says will protect the poor, help lift more New York workers into the middle class, and encourage immigrants to participate in city life regardless of documented status. The mayor is launching a new city ID program to allow immigrants who have problems getting IDs to obtain one. De Blasio also repeated his desire to have affluent New Yorkers pay a bit more in taxes. De Blasio says he wants to restore a sense of economic justice for working people. He says the city must head down the path of trying to close the income inequality gap. The New York City Retail Workers Union, RWDSU, meanwhile, is supporting an ordinance introduced in the New York City Council that would make organizing unions at retailers easier. The bill would keep retail stores and developments that get city subsidies from fighting union organizing efforts. Unions, in turn, would agree not to picket those stores.
Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays, noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
To the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com, or give us a call here, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. 520-7425. So, you know, and I look at the governor's speech the other day, and look, a lot in that speech, I'm just not at all, not even remotely thrilled with. And look, there are a number of Republicans not thrilled with it either. And I look at State Representative John McGinnis, not somebody I thought that I would ever be quoting because I see him as one of the way out extreme Tea Party types. But he wrote a piece for the front group, the Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania. Another one of these right-wing think tank groups who won't tell you where the money comes from, and you know where it's coming from. It's coming from the Koch brothers. It's coming from the billionaires who are pushing their message. Now, what I find interesting is McGinnis is calling for he's calling for people to be arrested in government. Because he asked the question, suppose a corporation CEO with the full approval of its board of directors has been siphoning off required pension contributions to cover other company expenses. He goes on to write, and suppose the CEO admitted as much in public and stated a policy of continuing to use employee-earned benefits in this manner. Does anyone doubt that this is both immoral and illegal? McGinnis writes, does anyone doubt that the CEO and the board of directors would likely go to jail? I do. I doubt that they would, because that kind of stuff has been happening in corporate America for years. But, you know, to McGinnis's point, to the Tea Party guy's point, and I find it cute, I find it very cute, that he seems to care about workers. This greed, the overarching point of it is we need to destroy those people's pensions. But he's got a point, and there are a couple of things in it that I do absolutely agree with. Because he points out that that our governor is doing just that. He writes, in his budget address, Governor Corbett proposed to continue a policy of shortchanging pension contributions in the name of budgetary relief. He writes, we now label the abdication of our constitutional duty and the misappropriation of employee-earned benefits as budgetary relief. And look, you know, we've been doing this for years, and I've been against it for years. And he points this out, and this is where, you know, I rarely give McGinnis credit for the things that he does, but in this instance, he's right. He asks the question, how do we claim we've balanced our state's budget in a year while we're simultaneously underfunding the public employee pension? And he points out, to his credit, that this is the primary reason for the unfunded liability of SERS and PSERS. He says, the failure of government to make its required contributions. The state government has been giving itself a funding holiday since 2003. And I would argue it's probably been even before that, that the Ridge administration stopped making contributions. And he points out that, you know, that we manage our state budgets, you know, you must adhere to the Constitution and the judicial interpretations, which according to him says that the pensions earned by public employees get the highest priority of state government revenues. He says the only moral constitutional approach is to fully fund the pensions in accord with the economic and accounting norms. To do otherwise is nothing less than dereliction. Now, this is probably one of the most, and I'm not even going to use conservative, because I actually have respect for honest conservatism. I actually have respect for people who stand on sound principles of true conservative value. Tea Party types, the people who just want to destroy government and profit for themselves in a handful, I have no respect for that. But I look at this position, and he's constitutionally accurate and spot on with identifying what the problem was. Problem was, for too long, politicians on both sides of the aisle, but mostly the people who say, we need lower taxes, which we know which party that is, they are the ones who have continually said we need lower taxes and have fostered this ability of us not to pay our bills. So that, as the governor pointed out, budgetary relief, which basically means we're going to steal from the future pensions. So I'm happy to see that somebody is paying attention. Someone on the Republican side is paying attention to this. Now, there is a way that we could meet our obligations. There is a way that we could meet our obligations and we could actually grow our economy. And I'm sure it's something Representative McGinnis would not be in favor of. But this idea that we're leaving hundreds of millions of dollars on the table by not accepting the Medicaid expansion, to me, is just wrongheaded and stupid. And according to a new study, and if the economic part of it isn't enough, if the economic part of the hundreds of millions of dollars coming into the state, 40,000 new jobs in healthcare, if that's not enough, the economic stimulator that this will be, if that's not enough, and if the moral argument that we take care of the least among us and we take care of those who can't afford to buy health insurance and we get them the care and the insurance that they need, if that's not enough, how about, and this is where I reach out to my pro-life friends. You know, it's one thing that, you know, we're going to stand out in front of an abortion clinic and wave a sign. How about making sure that we take care of the people who are here now? There's an idea. How about we take care of people who are alive right now? And there's a new study done by researchers at Harvard Medical School and the City University of New York. So these two fine institutions have come together. They have put out a new study based on the research that each institution has done. And what they have concluded is that the governor, by refusing to accept the Medicaid expansion money and to cover those low-wage workers under the Affordable Care Act, they say that in the next year, that this year, 2014, there will be 1,491 people who will lose their lives. More than four people each and every day will die because they don't have access to health care. Now, you know who these people are not. These are not the 1%. These are not the Koch brothers. These are not the wealth class. It's not the Corbetts. It's not our political class. It's not our CEOs. It's not our highfalutin, high society folks. It's not them. They're going to be fine. It's going to be those low-wage workers. And understand, it's not even going to be the really poor, because we're going to cover them anyway. It's that low wage, low end of the economic working scale, those fast food workers, those retail workers, those service industry, the people who clean your hotel rooms and wait on you on the restaurant. Now, think about that for a second. You got somebody who's waiting on you at the restaurant who's barely able to survive. And story after story, you hear people living in homeless shelters and they're serving you your food. And you gotta wonder, you know, what is it that the governor is stopping? Think about this. Four people, more than four people, each and every day. Each and every day will die in this Commonwealth because they don't have access to health care. Now, I would argue, probably could be much higher than that. And I know the other argument. Well, they're gonna die anyway. Eventually everybody dies, Rick. Don't you know that? Eventually everybody goes. Yeah, I do understand that. But what I also understand, I understand the demographic shift. I understand the socioeconomic shift. I understand that if you can afford to have regular preventative healthcare checkups, if you go to the doctor like my kid's doing and like I try to do every year to get blood tests and to get regular routine tests to make sure, hey, everything's normal. And if something's not, you go on and you have things checked so that you catch things early. If you can't afford to do that, your life expectancy is much shorter. I mean, that's just reality. And I would argue that the lifespan of the working poor in this country is being sacrificed so that we can have more profits for the handful. the investor class, the CEOs of these big insurance companies. You know, not too long ago, we talked to Wendell Young, Wendell Potter, the whistleblower from Cigna. And he was quite honest and said, look, you know, what he saw were these big companies who they were more interested in putting money in their pocket, more interested in the profit motive than they were in actually covering people and actually making sure that folks got the care that they needed. Because we've taken the health care out of it. It's really about health profits. How much money can these companies keep? And that's one of the things I like about the Affordable Care Act, that it caps that. And maybe we take some of the incentive to cut corners out of it. And maybe with the preventative part of it, we start seeing doctors more. And I remember back in 2010 when everyone was saying, well, you know, everybody's going to go to the doctor and everybody will just flood our healthcare system. And I remember at the time saying, well, good. I think we should be seeing the doctor more often. I should. I keep saying that myself. I should go. It's been about a year and a half since I went for my last physical, and I need to go and do it again. I think we should be spending more time on preventative maintenance. Just like your car, man. I change my oil every 3,000 miles. Wouldn't it make sense that I get a blood test at least every year to make sure that the levels are right? Doesn't that make sense? And do you do that? Because if not, we should be, as a society. And you know what ends up happening? And my doctor's told me this, and I know it to be true. If you do that, you get into a regular routine of getting checkups, it costs you less in the long run. It's like going to the dentist every year, man. I go twice a year. Get the cleanings, get the checkups. Fortunately, I've never had a cavity. Very happy with that. But in the long run, if you're taking care of it now, you know, who was that commercial? Earl Scheib. I remember. I don't even know if Earl Scheib's still around. Anybody know if Earl Scheib's still around? The guy who would paint any color, $39.95. And it's true. He would paint everything. If you didn't tape off the bumper or the windows, painted all of it. It was basically just like a car wash. You would drive your car through it, and it would just paint fly everywhere. But it was the same thing. You know, pay me now, pay me later. It's going to happen. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
You know what America needs? More jobs, that's what. Not Walmart-style jobettes, but real jobs, stable ones, with a good salary and benefits. Union jobs, so workers have a say in what goes on. Jobs that have strong protections against discrimination. A job you could make a career, do useful work, take pride in it, earn promotions, and be respected for what you do. Believe it or not, there is at least one place where such jobs still exist. But, and you really aren't going to believe this, those in charge are pushing like hell to eliminate them, turning positions that ought to be a model for American job growth into just another bunch of job ads. The place? Your local post office. Right-wing government haters in Congress, along with the corporate executives now sitting atop the U.S. Postal Service, claim that in order to save this icon of Americana, they must decimate it. These geniuses are privatizing the workforce, selling off the invaluable community facilities and shrinking services. Hello, the workers, facilities, and services are what make the post office iconic and give it such potential for even greater public use. Their latest ploy is a partnership with Staples, the big box office supply chain. In a pilot program, 82 Staples outlets have opened, quote, postal units to sell the most popular and most profitable mail products. Rather than being staffed by well-trained and knowledgeable postal workers, however, the many POs will have an ever-changing crew of Staples' low-wage temporary sales clerks with weak performance standards and no public accountability. This is Jim Hightower saying, cheapening postal work might be good for a few profiteers like Staples, but it will diminish postal service, and it's exactly the wrong direction for America to be going. For info and action, go to APWU.org. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
One of the objectives we have over the next couple months is to help folks understand some of the circumstances that lead folks to a life of poverty. It could just be one bad decision or one unfortunate circumstance that spirals to a life of poverty. And we hope to examine what those decisions are, what barriers are keeping folks in poverty, and helping to eliminate some of those barriers in the future for individuals and families across the state.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Our quote of the day, and much like the one yesterday, the Pope said, you know, when power, luxury, and money become idols, they take priority over the need for a fair distribution of wealth. Our consciousness need to be converted to justice, equality, simplicity, and sharing. And I find it interesting. You know, and this is one of those things that makes you go, maybe we should be rethinking our policies. You know, as last week, as Congress was talking about gutting a huge amount of money from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, the SNAP benefits, Jackie Spirit, the Democratic representative from California, she took to the floor, and you know, with a cooked steak, a bottle of vodka and a can of caviar. Well, she went after the Republicans, and rightfully so. She said in her district, the 14th district in California, she said, we have about 4,000 families who are on food stamps. But some of my colleagues, she says, have thousands and thousands more. Yet somehow, she says, they feel like crusaders, like heroes, when they vote to cut food stamps. Some of these same members travel to foreign countries, she says, under the guise of official business. They dine at lavish restaurants, eating steak, vodka, and even caviar. They receive money to do this. That's right. They don't pay out of their pocket for these meals. She said, let me give you a few examples. She goes on to point out that one member was given $127.41 a day for food on his trip to Argentina. She claimed it probably had a fair amount of steak while he was in Argentina. Another, she says, was given $3,588 for food and lodging during a 6-day trip to Russia. And according to her, he probably drank a fair amount of vodka and probably even had some caviar. She said that particular member has 21,000 food stamp recipients in his district. One of those people who is on food stamps could live a year on what this congressman spent on food and lodging for 6 days. And you know, the thing is there's no embarrassment by that. There's really not. Not with this crowd. There's really not. She goes on to say that another 20 members made a trip to Dublin, Ireland. They got $166 a day for food. She said these members didn't pay a dime. They received almost $200 for a single meal only for themselves. Yet, for them, the idea of helping fellow Americans spend less than $5 a day makes their skin crawl. She says families of veterans, of farmers, of the disabled, of the working poor are not visible to them, not even when they're their own constituents. And she goes, and you go back and you look at it, the member who went to Argentina, was Oklahoma Republican Frank Lucas. Spent $127 a day. Thanks to the think tank of the Franklin Center for Global Policy Exchange. Now, the Franklin Center for Global Policy Exchange, they're no stranger to lavish trips. In fact, you know, they were also the people who took the 20 members of Congress to Dublin. And I guess it cost something, according to roll call, somewhere around $750,000 to ship the 20 of them over there, picked up by the Franklin Center for Global Policy Exchange. Now, don't you think that that would come with a string or two? Just a thought. And the trip to Russia was done by Stephen King. Again, not the Stephen King, not the author, the Republican representative from Iowa. He's the one who went to Russia. And, you know, I look at Jackie Spirey, who I admire. You know, I do. She's, you know, on a certain level, you know, someone to be admired. Evidently, last Friday, you know, after this speech on Thursday, on Friday, she goes back to her district in the Bay Area in California, and she decides that she's going to go visit a homeless shelter. And I give her credit for it. You know, I give credit to anybody. And later on in the program, we're going to talk to Pat LaMarche, who spent a month on the road living in homeless shelters across the country, to get her thought on this. But the four-time congresswoman, she says she wanted to learn firsthand what it's like to experience the cruelty of poverty. And evidently, according to the San Francisco Chronicle, Jackie Spirey was up until the wee hours of the morning talking to people, the people who were there, the people who were staffed, the people, the guests, all of this stuff. And, you know, one of the things that she pointed out is one of the women worked at a grocery store. Her husband worked at an Office Max. Their son was working jobs. So all these people were working. They were just saving up to try and get an apartment, saving up enough money so that they could survive. What's interesting about the Bay Area there is that they have one of the highest rates of homelessness in the country, in spite of the fact that it's one of the wealthiest. I mean, you look at the tech boom and the wealth that is in that area, and some would argue that, you know, that they should be able to care for, and others would argue that that kind of massive wealth has actually sucked the resource out of the area, making homelessness worse. And you look at last year. According to the report, seven people froze to death in the Bay Area during one of the cold snaps. You think it's California? It doesn't get cold in California. Seven people froze to death. And I look at these cold days that we've been having, and that really just brutal stint that we had. And the fact that we just don't have, and I know, you know, people out of sight, out of mind. And it looks like the problem is getting worse, and the problem is getting worse. And what can the individual do? And look, you know, maybe we'll explore this a little bit later with Pat, but I don't think it's up to the individual. I think it's up to society. Each individual saying, we're not going to put up with it, and through our government, or through our churches, if that's the way you got to go, that's the way you got to go, or through whatever. But understand, the churches can't do it. They're not going to be able to do it. The need is so big, they're never going to be able to do it. And you hear these radical right-wingers say, well, you know, we spent all this money on the war on poverty. It was just a waste. It wasn't a waste. The war on poverty was lost almost immediately when Ronald Reagan became president. And I still remember the line, ketchup is a vegetable. I still remember the food programs that were cut by Ronald Reagan. And, you know, look, during the Bush years, during the George W. Bush years, every year that he was president, and this is one of those, again, you go back to the morality, you go back to the priorities, there was a very tiny, minuscule budget in the millions of dollars. And in a budget where you're talking, you know, several trillion dollars, a couple of million dollars going towards a program is not a lot of money. It was called the commodity supplemental food assistance program, the Commodity Supplemental Food Assistance Program. And what it was designed for is that farmers and people who would have excess, they would be able to sell it to kind of co-ops, and they would take the produce and stuff, and they would bag it, and seniors would get at least every month a bag of produce so that they would have something healthy, that they would have something that, you know, that maybe they couldn't afford, vegetables and stuff like that. Every year that Bush was in the White House, they gutted that out. Now, look, when they went through the budgeting process, it always got put back in. But the priority by the compassionate conservative was to gut that out of there. And that should make us all angry. I mean, it really should. But I look at our governor. I look at what our governor's done with the last three budgets. And I guess I shouldn't be surprised. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Working man like me. I ain't never been on welfare. That's one place I won't be. I'll be working as long as my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern. Sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Salvatore Calalori. On Fox News' America's Newsroom, Fox contributor Karl Rove criticized Senator Rand Paul's recent attempts to smear possible presidential candidate Hillary Clinton in an interview with co-host Bill Hemmer.
Rand Paul is out there. He's banging on the Clintons every day. Now, what's his strategy?
Yeah. Well, I'm not certain he has a strategy. I was intrigued the other day. Somebody said, why are you doing this? And he said, because people keep asking me about it. This can't be, I want to run for president. It's got to be about something bigger than that. And frankly, Rand Paul spending a lot of time talking about the mistakes of Bill Clinton does not look like a big agenda for the future of the country.
Rove's comments fly in the face of public statements made by RNC Chairman Reince Priebus during a recent appearance on MSNBC.
So, I mean, I think we're going to have a truckload of opposition research on Hillary Clinton, and some things may be old and some things might be new, but I think everything is at stake when you're talking about the leader of the free world.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425. Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
I feel my head to the new constitution. Take a bow.
That come November that we elect somebody who, you know, we don't get fooled again. I know I've got a lot of friends who say, well, I voted for Bill Clinton and I didn't like it. I mean, a lot of things about Clinton I wasn't thrilled with. A lot of things about Obama, not thrilled with. At the end of the day, though, not Bush, not Reagan. And look, I wish we could have real choices. I wish we had real progressive candidates and you know, put them up against anybody and actually have an honest conversation about the future of the country. And to be able to talk about it in a way that, look, I think we all know things are changing and changing rapidly. And what you've got on one side of the political denial is you've got people who don't want change. They've got their heads still stuck in the sand, and they think it's the 50s. And they think things can be done the same way. We've got to be open to a whole realm of new ideas on how, as a society, we move forward. And that's the key, as a society. The very well-to-do are always going to be okay. Don't worry about them. They'll be fine. They've got their lobbyists. They've got their money. They can always hire enough of us to protect them. We know that. Question is, what about the rest of the folks? And, you know, there's a push right now going on across the country to raise the minimum wage. This push to say, you know what, 7 1/4? I don't know how anyone lives on 7 1/4. I don't know how anyone makes it to the next day, to the next week, to the next month on such a paltry sum. What I find interesting, now there's a push. There's a push to raise the minimum wage up to $10.10 an hour. In fact, today, a group calling themselves the Smart Capitalists for American Prosperity, they released a letter to Congress and to the president saying, hey, you know what? We demand that there be a higher minimum wage. We demand that workers be paid a reasonable, self-sustaining wage. Now, I understand tomorrow there's going to be a big press conference in D.C., a bipartisan press conference. You're going to get, you know, a whole bunch of Democrats and Republicans who are going to say, you know what, we need to be raising this minimum wage. And I look at some of the names in this group. Like, you know, the reality is it's good for business. These are the business types saying, hey, it's good for business. The more money workers have in their pocket, the more they go to spend. And it's something I've been saying for years now. The more disposable income, the more you got jinging around in your pocket, the more that's bouncing around in your pockets there, the more you're going to spend. It's just that simple. And, you know, my uncle, who's a very rich guy, extraordinarily wealthy guy, said, look, I could give, you know, all of you little people all kinds of money, and at the end of the day, I'm still going to get it back. And I said, okay, that's a good idea. Let's do that. Now, he had taken this high road that, you know, we're superior to you and, you know, you don't know what to do with your money. And I go, whoa, whoa, whoa. No, that's exactly how the game is played. Okay, if you believe that eventually you get all the money, well, give it all to us and then you'll get it back. But you'll get it back after all of these folks' lives are just a little bit better, that they can afford to put food on the table and a roof over their head and buy some of your products and increase your productivity capacity and your profit margins. Yes, I'm with you. He wasn't thrilled with that idea. It's mine. It's that hoarder mentality. It's like when I was in high school and you used to buy a little carton of French fries and you would stand there with your arms around it so no one could steal one of your fries. It's the same thing. I mean, it's high school just with large amounts of money. Pretty much that's the end of it. Not to mention, according to the capitalists, I love the name. You gotta love the name, right? Smart capitalists for American prosperity. Love that. They say it's good for the American taxpayers. Why? Well, because if you're making more money, maybe, and this is where you go back to the Romney. You go back to the Romney who said, well, 47% of the people don't pay any federal income tax. Do you know why they don't pay any federal income tax, Mittens? Because they don't make enough money. Their wages aren't high enough. So if you raise their wages high enough that they can pay federal income tax, guess what happens? That's right. More tax dollars going into government, going into paying for roads and bridges and education and health care and all the things that we're demanding. Seems smart to me. Also, according to the smart capitalists for American prosperity, they claim it's good for America's global leadership. They say the U.S. is the richest country in the world, but its minimum wage significantly trails just about every other industrialized developed country in the world. They say in order to maintain its global leadership, the U.S. must ensure decent earnings for its workers. And I would say, beyond raising the minimum wage, the rights of workers to organize. I think that's a place where you start. Now, understand, the wealth class, not all that thrilled with the idea of raising the minimum wage. So they've got their front group flacks out there, the Rick Bermans of the world. And I'm sure you've heard of Rick Berman. He's one of these guys who does he has a public relations firm in Washington and a bunch of front groups. One of the front groups is something called the Employment Policies Institute, EPI, kind of like the more progressive Economic Policy Institute, but only insane. And what's interesting about it is this New York Times article goes and talks to them where they're pretty honest that, you know, this nonprofit entity of, you know, the economic or the Employment Policies Institute is basically just kind of a front group. It's their non-profit group that is done by the profit group that he owns. And pretty much honest about it. You know, the reality is that they're front groups for the Restaurant Association. They're front groups for the low-waged employers of the country. So when you see these messages, when you see the wealth class saying that, well, we can't raise it, it's just going to destroy our economy, understand who's behind it. It's these people, the people who now control everything. It's just, well, it is what it is. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com. Also, Stitcher, smartphone. Email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally, especially during the program. I got a bunch on Benghazi I'm going to get to a little bit later, a couple on homelessness, a lot of stuff to get to. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Right-wing anti-union Tennessee politicians are now threatening to withhold further incentives from the state for expansion of the VW Chattanooga plant if the workers there decide to join the UAW this week. The historic election will be held Wednesday through Friday. Republican State Senator Beau Watson said at a press conference that should the workers choose to go union, he believes any additional state incentives for expansion of the VW plant would have a hard time passing the Tennessee Senate. VW is neutral in this election, but outside right-wing groups are running an anti-union campaign in Chattanooga. Pro-union VW workers featured in a UAW video expressed excitement at the prospect of the VW plant going UAW. VW Chattanooga worker Justin King says that a German-style co-determination model with union-represented workers and management working together would be good for VW.
Volkswagen will be stronger when they come together with the UAW because that combines not only Volkswagen's history of working with labor, but it also adds in the UAW's experience of working in the U.S. market.
Tammy Flint can't wait. to vote for the UAW.
I'm excited. I can't wait. I was in the union for 15 years in the UAW, so I know what stuff they bring to the table with them. And I think it'll be a great thing. I just can't wait for this to get started. I'm ready for it.
Ed Hunter says the UAW effort at VW has been a grassroots worker effort from the start.
It's been a grassroots effort from the beginning that we invited the UAW in to start this campaign and help us through this transition.
Tennessee Republican leaders say VW is supporting the UAW, so that's why they're threatening to withhold any future state incentives for VW expansion. VW announced in January it's investing $7 billion in the North American market over the next 5 years. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio delivered his State of the City speech on Monday. He touted policies he says will protect the poor, help lift more New York workers into the middle class, and encourage immigrants to participate in city life regardless of documented status. The mayor is launching a new city ID program to allow immigrants who have problems getting IDs to obtain one. De Blasio also repeated his desire to have affluent New Yorkers pay a bit more in taxes. De Blasio says he wants to restore a sense of economic justice for working people. He says the city must head down the path of trying to close the income inequality gap. The New York City Retail Workers Union, RWDSU, meanwhile, is supporting an ordinance introduced in the New York City Council that would make organizing unions at retailers easier. The bill would keep retail stores and developments that get city subsidies from fighting union organizing efforts. Unions, in turn, would agree not to picket those stores.
Workers Independent News is proud.
I know many of you are going to be interested in this next subject. Pennsylvania sits within a day's drive of 60% of the nation's population. Every year, nearly $500 billion worth of goods and services move through our state transportation system. Transportation is the bloodstream of our economy. If it fails, our economy fails. However, as you know, the average bridge in our state is 51 years old.
No walls, come tumble it down. The walls, come tumble it, tumble it. The walls, come tumble it, tumble it down.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, I listened to that statement, and look, I mean, it's good that he recognized that, and you look at the transportation bill that they passed last year, not anywhere near what we needed. In fact, his own transportation commission says, look, we needed $3.5 billion just to meet our needs, not to exceed, not to upgrade, not to look to the future, just to maintain, just to get even. Just to level out. And, you know, we talked about this a little bit yesterday. And it's one of those things that I think is ultimately one of the key issues of our time. How much should we be privatizing? How much of what we, the people in the past, have done for ourselves should we be putting into the hands of the profiteers? And, you know, we talked about this public-private partnership stuff yesterday, and the program, the Rapid Bridge Replacement Program, which on January 30th evidently went into place, where now you've got all of these bridges, something like 500 that they were going to bundle and put into 35, 40-year contracts, which is a very long time. And, you know, as I was thinking about this last night, and I talked a little bit about this, but it's been banging around in my head that, you know, there's a lot of questions in all of this. And there have been numerous studies out there that talk about the high costs of privatization. And we talked a little bit about the Chicago, the parking meters there and the parking garages and the parking stuff in Pittsburgh. And really, you know, you look down the list of all of the, you know, the Skyway and all the turnpikes and all the roads and, you know, all of the stuff that we've privatized. You got to ask the question, what does it really cost? And is it going to be cheaper to, and this is where it all breaks down for me. They're telling us that it's going to be cheaper to do if the private sector does it with private money. And there's really, the way that the article I read yesterday made it sound is that they can't toll any of the roads or any of the bridges. And I'm going, well, how do they get their money back if they can't toll the road? If you can't put up toll boxes. You can't put the easy pass stuff. Where are you going to get your money? Now, this is what the PennDOT person was saying. That, you know, it's not going to, you know, we're not going to toll the roads, we're not going to put up anything. But the law is pretty explicit, according to the report that I read, that there are user fees, which, you know, last time I checked, user fees were tolls. Like when we built the Pennsylvania Turnpike, we did it with tolls, which we're still paying, by the way, for the upgrade. And now what we're doing is we're even doing away with the workers there by mechanizing all of that. But you've got some of these 500 bridges that are part of this rapid replacement that are going to be privatized. They're going to be in the hands of someone else. So I guess the question you have to ask is, you know, by hiring all of these outside firms, these, you know, who knows where from, you know, these consultants, the engineers, the construction crews, you know, is it going to be cheaper? And then what happens while we don't have control of these bridges? What happens if technology outlives the bridges? What happens if, you know, we have something that, and I use the parking garages often, because that's the analogy, that's the story that I get. In Chicago, and I've, you know, I've had a number of people tell me this, if they want to have a parade, the city has to pay all the parking meters for 24 hours. So if nobody parks there, it doesn't matter. And if someone still parks there, they get the money for that too, from what I'm told. So it's a win, it's a major win-win for them. So, you know, in the interim, you go, well, what happens if, you know, we privatize these bridges and we decide that, you know, we would really like to have public transportation. Or we would like to have a policy put forth by the state that encourages, say, carpooling. So that you put some incentive into carpooling, maybe a high occupancy lane or something along those lines. Can you do it? And I would have to argue no. I would have to argue that in the contract they're going to, like, these are smart people who know how to turn a buck. And they're going to rig the contract in their favor, not in yours and mine. Because the politicians, they just want stuff done. They want you happy. They want the roads to be pothole free. And however they can do that as quickly as possible without having to raise taxes, never mind the tolls. And we won't call a toll a tax, will we? We won't call quote unquote user fees. We won't call those taxes, will we? I mean, you're still coming out of your pocket, right? But what happens once you sign these multi-generational contracts? What happens? I mean, you know, you look at 40 years, that's two generations? What's going to happen down the road? And I love the frame that we hear from people. Well, that's intergenerational theft. That's what all this borrowing is. Well, what is this? I mean, seriously. And then I had a couple of other thoughts. And I always, look, I'm a working class guy. And I've been very honest about that right from the start. I look at things from a worker's perspective. What does this mean? What do these P3 means? The P3s mean? What? And as I sat here and I was thinking about it, what it basically means is now you're going to be able to, because look, the Stephen Blooms of the world, the Daryl Metcalfs, the Seth Groves, the Cutlers, the far out right wing portion of the Republican Party, they despise workers. They despise anything that gets people a reasonable wage. And prevailing wage is one of those things that just sends them into a tizzy. How dare those construction workers make a decent living? We need to destroy that. This, in my view, is one of those ways that stuff gets destroyed. Because as I'm thinking about it, and as I'm looking at it, so now you've privatized the construction, which now you don't have to deal with the baby bacons, the prevailing wage law, which means then, hey, you don't really need to hire even Pennsylvania workers. You can bring transient crews from anywhere. Right? Or am I missing something? And you can pay them, and what the heck, if they're a global corporation, at some point I'm sure they're going to figure out how to bring in global employees like they did in Oakland. If you remember the Bay Bridge, that they didn't use American labor. They actually brought Chinese welders in because, oh, we just don't have enough welders. Really? We don't have enough welders? We can't train people fast enough to be welders? Really? You know, I had friends that, you know, told me it was, you trained to be a decent welder in about 9 months. Now, to be a really good welder takes a long time. I mean, it is a skilled trade. But to learn how to just, to be a decent welder takes about 9 months. But we had to import them from China. And, of course, use the cheap Chinese-made steel. And that's the other question that I then have. What if, you know, what if we had the nerve to say that anything built in Pennsylvania with taxpayer dollars had to be made in Pennsylvania? Because we still make steel in Pennsylvania. Understand that. We still have a couple of steel mills that actually produce as much steel as they did during the heyday. I mean, we're producing a lot of steel. But what if we had a proposal, a rule that said, hey, use Pennsylvania steel. You buy local. And they say, no, we want to buy Chinese steel because it's a lot cheaper and we can save money because we're cutting costs. Thoughts? I mean, because I look at this and I'm going, that's where it's going, man. That's where this stuff is going to take us. We're going to start outsourcing insourcing the jobs from overseas and bringing in foreign products when we could make it right here. Now, to me, construction has always been one of those things that generates economic activity. That the more you build, the more jobs you create, the more money you put into those people's pocket, the more they spend in the local stores, the more they employ local employees who then have money in their pockets to buy things from other stores and from other people and so on and so on. And you have this snowball effect of growing forward. And I'm sure these smart capitalists for American prosperity would agree with me. That's the place where we want to get to. But I look at this privatization scheme, and I'm not seeing that. What I'm seeing is we're going to put a bunch of corner cutters and penny pinchers and people who, when they grab a quarter, the eagle screams, we're going to put them in charge of producing the things that my kid rides over on the bus. And that I'm going to have to go over at some point in my car, and maybe, who knows? You know, I'm going to have some concrete work done around my house here soon. And the guy who does the work, who I like, one of those, you get a gut feeling about people, at least I do, and I get a good feeling about this guy. And right from the start, he goes, well, let me ask you right from the start, do you want the cheap concrete or you want the good stuff? He goes, because I can give you both prices. He goes, I'm not going to tell you I'm going to give you the good stuff and then cheat you with the garbage. But it's up to you. If you want to save the couple $100, get the garbage. Granted, it's only going to last you probably 10, 15 years at best, and then you'll have a whole headache with it. Or you get the good stuff, and it'll last a lot longer. It's up to you. It's a couple $100. Now, if the bottom line were all I was thinking about, you know, the couple $100, what do I care? It's going to be somebody else's in 35 or 40 years. Long as it lasts that long, planned obsolescence, I don't care. So there's a lot to think about. Now, when the governor put this out back in April of 2012, when this went into effect and they passed it and signed it with a wonderful thing saying, oh, how fantastic, we can now do all of this wonderful work and it's not going to cost us any money. Not going to cost us any money, and it's going to bring jobs, and it's going to be fantastic. And I remember the PennDOT secretary and the P3 board chairman saying, you know, when Governor Corbett signed the P3 legislation into law, he gave us a tool to find more ways to work with private businesses to meet our transportation needs and expand the services we deliver. He said this project is a prime example of how investment in the public sector empowers strong partnerships within the private sector, leading to increased safety, good-paying jobs, and better service for all Pennsylvanians. And you know what? The way he lays it out, the way it makes it sound, I'm like, yeah, wow, that's great, fantastic. How do we do that? This ain't it. At least I don't think this is it. Now, I've heard some people, you know, some of my friends say, well, you know, P3s are, yeah, it's just the wave of the future. We're going to have to deal with it. I think it's a bad idea. But we do need to look in, walk into it with the eyes wide open. And we're going this way. So this is going to happen. I don't see it stopping. So the idea is that you've got to pay attention to it. Eyes wide open. You're going to be told more. There are going to be easy pass tolls everywhere. And eventually what they're going to do is they're going to mandate it in every car. So that, and this is where we're going, whether you like it or not, every car is going to be taxed or tolled, whatever, on every mile that we drive. That's how we're going to fund our roads, and that's how we're going to fund the bridges. And there are some that think that's a good idea. I don't know. But that's where we're heading. And that's where all this is going. So be aware of it. And the privateers know this. The people who sit behind the scenes and orchestrate this stuff, they know this. They know this is where we're going. And they're positioning themselves. Because, you know, good businessmen look to the future. They're positioning themselves when all of this stuff is privatized that they can really cash in. And that's just the way I see it. And it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds as the next couple of years go by. And if it's going to work, I don't know. Well, we shall soon see. Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
America. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
You know what America needs? More jobs, that's what. Not Walmart-style jobettes, but real jobs, stable ones, with a good salary and benefits. Union jobs, so workers have a say in what goes on. Jobs that have strong protections against discrimination. A job you could make a career, do useful work, take pride in it, earn promotions, and be respected for what you do. Believe it or not, there is at least one place where such jobs still exist. But, and you really aren't going to believe this, those in charge are pushing like hell to eliminate them, turning positions that ought to be a model for American job growth into just another bunch of jobettes. The place? Your local post office. Right-wing government haters in Congress, along with the corporate executives now sitting atop the U.S. Postal Service, claim that in order to save this icon of Americana, they must decimate it. These geniuses are privatizing the workforce, selling off the invaluable community facilities and shrinking services. Hello, the workers, facilities, and services are what make the post office iconic and give it such potential for even greater public use. Their latest ploy is a partnership with Staples, the big box office supply chain. In a pilot program, 82 Staples outlets have opened, quote, postal units to sell the most popular and most profitable mail products. Rather than being staffed by well-trained and knowledgeable postal workers, however, the many POs will have an ever-changing crew of Staples' low-wage temporary sales clerks with weak performance standards and no public accountability. This is Jim Hightower saying, cheapening postal work might be good for a few profiteers like Staples, but it will diminish postal service, and it's exactly the wrong direction for America to be going. For info and action, go to APWU.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small. by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all.
It's class warfare. My class is winning, but they shouldn't be.
A working class hero is something to be.
The taxation system has tilted toward the rich and away from the middle class.
A working class hero is something to be.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Yes, yes, I agree with Warren Buffett. The taxation system has tilted away from the workers and toward the rich to where, you know what, all the tax breaks, all of the incentives, that's where they go. And when you start talking about, hey, you know, we need jobs and, hey, we need this or that, or we need to make sure that we have the ability to make a living, boy, can't have any of that. And in fact, what they're shoving down our throats right now, the poison that we're hearing, and I don't know if you saw this, but the House Bill 1807, Republican Seth Groves' piece of legislation that would make it illegal for any township, any municipality, any city, any borough, any political subdivision, as they say. That's anywhere where you live here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, that it would be illegal for you to say in your neck of the woods you want to make sure that workers have vacation pay, a day off, a sick day, maybe paid medical leave, maybe paid family leave, any of that stuff. It would be illegal. Illegal. Think about this. I mean, this is what's amazing to me. These are the people who say we don't want centralized control. We don't like big government. We believe in local. But yet here again, our Republican friends pushing their poison. And it's not even their poison. Look, their ideology is one thing. When the campaign cash talks, that's what's really important. So here again, it was introduced last November. It's been, the first consideration was on the 18th. Laid on the table. Then it was removed from the table, laid back on the table, removed from the table. It's now laid back on the table. So it's something that's going to be considered. Maybe that goes for second consideration. Who knows? Personally, I think this is more of the attempt by the wealth class of this country to homogenize the Republican Party even further. This is one of those litmus tests, if you will, that says, well, either you're with us, the anti-worker crowd, or you're with them, those unwashed masses, those people who get their hands dirty with calluses on their palms. We don't want to be around any of those people, do we? That's basically what this is about. And, you know, I look at this push towards making Pennsylvania a right-to-work state. I love that. Because I truly believe in a right-to-work. Absolutely, positively, inexplicably, I believe in a right-to-work. I believe that every person who wants a job should be able to get one, even if that means government is the employer of last resort. I do. I absolutely believe it. But the people who push the poison, known as the current version of right-to-work, has nothing to do with any rights, and there's no work. It's basically working for less. And the labor community hasn't figured out a new term, hasn't figured out anything to counter the Madison Avenue, Park Avenue type PR focus group tested, think tank approved messaging, bumper sticker sloganeering that the right has, and they're losing the battle. And you can come out with study after study, and the most recent study on the right-wing version of right-to-work comes from Missouri, because there's a heavy push right now in Missouri to go after the workers there to make Missouri a right-to-work state. And understand, Pennsylvania is on the list. The moneyed interest, once they get Missouri, Pennsylvania is on the list, trust us. Now, a new report was released yesterday by Michael Kelsey. He's a professor at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. And what he comes up with is basically what we know. I mean, there's nothing really new here. So Pennsylvania, when we make when someone decides to do this study and makes it Pennsylvania-centric, it's going to be about the same thing because we've learned this stuff in state after state that, have gone this route. Now, according to the paper, an economic analysis of the adaption of Right to Work on Missouri Families, they come up with some pretty staggering numbers. They find that if this poison were to be pushed in Missouri, the economic loss per household, per individual household, would be somewhere between $1,900 and $2,500 per household. So think about your household, not even just a union household. This is every household. You're talking about a push down, a cram down of wages on every worker. Union, non-union, doesn't matter. Everybody sees the downward pressure on wages. Somewhere in the neighborhood of $1,900 to $2,500. So if you're struggling to make ends meet now, folks of Missouri, and soon to be folks of Pennsylvania, it's going to get worse. What they also come up with is that the amount being lost, the yearly wage loss, would be somewhere between $4.5 and $6 billion each and every year in Missouri because of lower wages. And then you throw that in with the local tax base that we use, because if your wages are going down, the tax base is going to go down. State, local, county, you know, the municipal stuff, all of those taxes, you would lose, according to the report, somewhere between $82 and $107 million a year in lost sales tax. Just because of the lower wages, because people aren't spending the money. The money's not going into the economy. People don't have the disposable income, so you're not getting the sales tax, and you're not getting the state taxes and all of that based on wages. Then you throw in the reality that in the states that have already accepted the poison, they're already dying from this poison, have a much higher population of people living below the poverty line. So when we start, and look, the moneyed interests are going to start pushing this here. It's coming. And even if you're not a union member, understand that upward pressure on wages benefits everyone, just as the downward pressure affects everyone. Understand, in the southern states and in all the other right-to-work states, you see much higher rates of poverty. You see much lower per capita GDP growth. And I know the right wants to keep telling it, and they love to regurgitate the same talking point ad nauseum, because it's what they do. But this idea, this fallacy, this idiotic fallacy that somehow, some way, if we just took these rights away from those workers, the businesses would come flying in here. We could steal jobs from New York. We could steal jobs from Ohio. We could steal jobs from New Jersey. We could just steal. As much as they want that to be the frame, unfortunately, well, it's just not the reality. The reality is there's no real boom. Indiana is the proof of that. They want to keep saying that Indiana has had a boom. They haven't. You know, it's kind of like the Corbett administration saying, oh, well, our job market's fantastic because we're giving away all these tax handouts. The sad reality is it ain't helping. Not working, man. So what does that leave us with? Well, it leaves us with, and this is not difficult to figure out, this leads to lower wages for all working people and higher profit margins on the short term for the investor class. And that's all they care about. Look, we live in an economy where they only seem to care about the next quarter. They don't care about the quarter after that, or the year, or 5 years, or 10 years. Here now. Carpe diem. I'll always love that one. And you can go down the list of other things. I mean, the incidence of workplace fatalities, much considerably higher. Higher injury rates. Higher rates of poverty. Higher rates of high school dropouts. you know, lower spending on education. You could just go down the list of all the negatives that come along with this. So when someone asked me the other day, well, why do I care? I'm never going to be a union member. I work in an office. I said, well, you probably need one. You probably should be looking into that right now because you're eventually going to get mechanized right out of a job. But understand, it's that upward pressure. And it's the voice of those unions to stop the really ugly stuff, like the privatization of our lottery, like the privatization of our wine and spirit shops, like the evisceration of education and the privatization of education, and just down the line, which is why the Republicans have to go after them, which is why workers must be silenced, because, well, why would we want to hear their opinion? Which is why the right wing is going nuts in Tennessee right now over this situation at Volkswagen, where the workers, they say they want to be represented by the United Auto Workers. And Volkswagen's going, okay, have an election. If you get the number of people to sign up for it, and you get enough people, that fine, we'll negotiate with them. Which is driving the right wing just ballistic. So I can't wait to talk to Chris Brown when we come back. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You know they're going to push us around. Mr. Theft and Digging, Mr. Harlequin Hauler, because I'm going to leave it in the ground. Mr. Theft and Digging, Mr. Harlequin Hauler, Mr. Reagan can supervise the crew. And if they find it too hard, they got the National Guard to fix the bayonets and shovel like fools. It's gonna take a lot longer than 80 short days for this miner to cool on down. This half can dig it, Mr. Harley can haul it, cause I'm gonna leave it in the ground.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Right-wing anti-union Tennessee politicians are now threatening to withhold further incentives from the state for expansion of the VW Chattanooga plant if the workers there decide to join the UAW this week. The historic election will be held Wednesday through Friday. Republican State Senator Beau Watson said at a press conference that should the workers choose to go union, he believes any additional state incentives for expansion of the VW plant would have a hard time passing the Tennessee Senate. VW is neutral in this election, but outside right-wing groups are running an anti-union campaign in Chattanooga. Pro-union VW workers featured in a UAW video expressed excitement at the prospect of the VW plant going UAW. VW Chattanooga worker Justin King says that a German-style co-determination model with union-represented workers and management working together would be good for VW.
Volkswagen will be stronger when they come together with the UAW because that combines not only Volkswagen's history of working with labor, but it also adds in the UAW's experience of working in the U.S. market.
Tammy Flint can't wait to vote for the UAW.
I'm excited. I can't wait. I was in the union for 15 years in the UAW, so I know what stuff they bring to the table with them. And I think it'll be a great thing. I just can't wait for this to get started. I'm ready for it.
Ed Hunter says the UAW effort at VW has been a grassroots worker effort from the start.
It's been a grassroots effort from the beginning that we invited the UAW in to start this campaign and help us through this transition.
Tennessee Republican leaders say VW is supporting the UAW, so that's why they're threatening to withhold any future state incentives for VW expansion. VW announced in January it's investing $7 billion in the North American market over the next 5 years. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio delivered his State of the City speech on Monday. He touted policies he says will protect the poor, help lift more New York workers into the middle class, and encourage immigrants to participate in city life regardless of documented status. The mayor is launching a new city ID program to allow immigrants who have problems getting IDs to obtain one. De Blasio also repeated his desire to have affluent New Yorkers pay a bit more in taxes. De Blasio says he wants to restore a sense of economic justice for working people. He says the city must head down the path of trying to close the income inequality gap. The New York City Retail Workers Union, RWDSU, meanwhile, is supporting an ordinance introduced in the New York City Council that would make organizing unions at retailers easier. The bill would keep retail stores and developments that get city subsidies from fighting union organizing efforts. Unions, in turn, would agree not to picket those stores.
Workers
in Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee in a right-to-work state at a low cost with less health care. Why should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? It's time to let these people learn the lesson.
You know, I want to
This is what I want to be.
Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick at therickssmithshow.com. You know, you listen to Zach Wamp, the congressman from Tennessee, you know, going on, wanting the auto workers to fail, wanting Detroit to go down the tubes, propping Volkswagen up as the, you know, as the prize. This is the way it should be. It's interesting now that you see politicians in Tennessee now veiled threats. I look at the state's Senate Speaker Pro Tem, a guy named Bo Watson, who held a news conference on Monday saying, you know, it's un-American for workers to want to have a voice where they work. It's un-American. And the veiled threat that, you know what, you know, we gave you a bunch of money, Volkswagen. We can maybe take that away. Interesting times. But, you know, as I've been saying for the longest time, you know, there is organizing going on in the South, and there are people who have had enough, and they want a voice on the job, which is why we've asked Chris Brown. He's a worker at the Volkswagen plant to come talk to us. Also one of the folks who, you know, saying, hey, I'd like to have a voice where I work. Chris, thanks for taking time for us.
And thank you, sir. I'm glad to be on your program today.
You know, I look at this, and, you know, they say that you can't organize workers in the South. I see it going on all the time, and, you know, the frame doesn't fit the reality, in my view.
Yes, sir. My old man always said you can hear anything but money rattle and meat fry. You hear that, but down here in the South, people can organize too.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that. I've heard a lot of things. That's a new one on me. But, you know, here's the thing. You know, here's the thing. And I find it very interesting that corporate America, that a bunch of right-wing think tanks, a bunch of right-wing groups, are just losing their mind that a company here in this country has said, you know what, if our workers want to join a union, they should be allowed, and the company's going to stay neutral. I find it amazing that the right has almost lost their mind over this.
Yes, I find it amazing, too, because, I mean, the American system is democracy, and Volkswagen is a company that recognizes its employees' right, and it applauds democracy. It wants democracy in its factories. And of all the countries on earth, you would think that the United States would recognize that, and our elected officials would recognize that, and they would applaud that. They said we have some politicians who are going against democracy. Yeah. They are democratically elected. How would they feel if they were being denied the right to even vote themselves?
Well, but Chris
is openly offering us a voice.
But Chris, the people who are against this, the people who are fighting you, are people who want to take your vote away as well to vote for them. I mean, you look at all the voter suppression stuff that's going on across this country. It's the same forces.
Yes, and it is just wrong. I mean, why would you want to, if you're a democratically elected person, why would you want to take somebody's vote away unless you're not really for the people?
That's an excellent way of looking at it. So let me walk me back through this because, you know, we had heard for the longest time that everything's wonderful and things are terrific and, you know, that workers, you know, they didn't want to have a voice. They didn't need it. So walk me through the process of how you guys at the Volkswagen plant, some 1,500 of you, decide that, you know what, we'd like to have some say in what we do. We'd like to have a little voice in the place where we spend a good portion of our lives.
Yes. This organizing drive began 2.5 years ago, sir. It has grown since then. And our company openly embraces the idea of this. Our company has a works council. We wish to form a works council, which is a new idea. It is an innovative new model for the 21st century. This is the pace setter that we're developing here, and our company embraces this. They want us to have a voice. It is like when I turned 18 in this country, I gained my right to vote. When I filled out the draft, I was eligible to vote in this country. My company is now freely offering me to write to have a voice in my company where I earn a living. This is where I make my life. This is where I spend the majority of my working hours. Why would any man turn down his right to vote when being freely offered to him by his company?
It's a good question. Why? So I can't imagine that there are an awful lot of people who are against this then, right?
And there are a few people against it. Some people are afraid of change, though. I mean, we know that in life. But, and some people have Stockholm.
And, you know, I'm glad you said that. I am glad you said that, because I got to be honest. I think I'm the only other person that I've ever heard use that frame that, you know, workers in this country have been suffering with Stockholm Syndrome for years because we've been abused and beaten and pushed down, that we actually identify with. I'm so glad that you use that frame.
Yeah, thank you, sir. But, I mean, you see it on the job site. You see some people that do have Stockholm Syndrome. And it in the South, you see it the worst. But this is the place where it can turn around. Workers can open their eyes, be enlightened, be educated, and see that there is a different life, a better life.
Do you think that the reason that the radical right in this country, the corporatists, if you will, the corporate class, do you think that they fear exactly what you've said, that if they can get this one foothold in a southern right-to-work state like Tennessee, where workers say, you know what, we demand to have some of the say in what happens, a discussion in determining what direction we take as a company, do you think that the fear is that other people will join on, and that there could be a wave of organizing that goes on across this country that they can no longer control?
Yes, I do believe that is the situation. These men right now have absolute authority, and any man with absolute authority fears losing any of that authority. And I believe they really do fear it, because they know that from this point on, it isn't going to be a story about somebody who lives 600 miles from here. It's going to be a story about their neighbor and no. where he works at, about the difference that's made in his life and in his factory.
Now, you know, I got to be honest with you, Chris. I tell my story all the time. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. We were poor by any standard, and you know, it was because of my union card. It's because of that contract that paid me a good wage for the hours that I put in, that I now live in a neighborhood with doctors and lawyers. And it, to me, was that opportunity, that helping hand, that gave me the ticket to the middle class. And I think, again, we need to be telling those stories, which is why I thought it was so important that I get someone before this election happened, and hopefully as it goes on and on beyond, that tell those stories, that this is that ticket to the middle class. This is my chance to a better life, not just for myself, but for my kids and my grandkids and my community.
Yes, I can tell you a very similar story to my family. My grandfather was a member of the miners union at Tennessee Copper Company. Back many years ago, my grandfather was injured in those mines, and it broke one of his arms. And thanks to the union, the company wanted to just cut him out on workers' comp, and the union said, no, this man can still do something useful here. And they managed to have him trained as an electrician. Well, my grandfather went through all the training, became a full-blown electrician, and ultimately he ended up being the head electrician at Tennessee Copper Company in the 1970s.
It's that opportunity.
And it was all thanks to a union. Yeah. Yes, he was given the opportunity.
Otherwise, without that opportunity, what do you think would have happened to him? I mean, I can't imagine, you know, once you're then thrown out as old used trash, I don't know that anybody picks you up, right?
No, I mean... Copper Hill, Tennessee Copper Company, you either worked there or you really didn't have a job. I mean, it controlled the area pretty much. It was the one job to have. There were no other jobs that even compared to it. If it had not been for a union, I think where my family would have been today.
And that's a story that I think needs to be told often. Let me ask you this, and looking at Volkswagen, as I understand it, the Chattanooga, Tennessee plant is the only plant in the world that doesn't have some sort of union, some type of work council, some type of mechanism for workers to have some say in what goes on. Is that accurate?
Yes, that is accurate, sir. To the best of my knowledge, that is accurate. We are the only Volkswagen plant around the world that does not have union representation.
So in other places, they've figured out how to exist and to coexist and actually to thrive. While what we hear from the people who want to fear us to death and keep us at the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of need, of scare and fear and want, they've figured it out. They figured that, you know, their workers are part of the equation, not just tools to be used and discarded, as I get it.
Yes, Volkswagen realizes that its workers, when in power, what you're doing, you're bringing them actively into the environment. They're no longer just a worker who comes home, does his job, and goes. Comes to work, does his job, goes home. He's a worker who is involved in his job. And an involved worker is a better worker.
Absolutely.
And every worker has one thing that is unique to him. It's a brain. And the more brains you have working on that problem, while he may be using his hands every day building that car, he also has a mind up here that's thinking. And Volkswagen realizes this. Volkswagen is not about a combative relationship with the union. Volkswagen is about a collaborative relationship with its workers.
Let me hit on that, because that's probably the most important point in all of this. Because what we've been fed for years is that worker relationships with management always have to be adversarial. That when unions are involved, it's always adversarial, and that the two can't sit down and come to an amicable agreement that both sides benefit from and actually move forward and prosper from. And I think it's the right wing of this country, the corporate class of this country, who has perpetuated this myth to keep us divided and pitted against one another.
Yes, I agree with you. I agree with you. I believe that it's the corporate level that does that too, the elitist in this country, because there is no written rule that it has to be combative. It is better if it's collaborative, because if the company succeeds, then I can succeed with the company. I cannot very well succeed with the company faltering, and the company can succeed to a lesser extent with me faltering, but the company can succeed so much better if I am succeeding with it, because then I am invigorated and want to be more of a part of it because I am succeeding with the company. And Volkswagen realizes it, and they know it, and they've built it into their culture, and I praise them for it.
Let me ask you about the work councils, Chris, because, you know, this is,
yes.
I think as you accurately pointed out, this is a little different model than what American labor is used to. It's a little different model than I think, and I'm not even sure that how it's going to work. It's going to be an interesting experiment going forward that I think everybody will be looking to as maybe the model of the future. Who knows? Tell me what you think this is, and tell me how you see this working.
Well, the Works Council is a form of dual representation, and in the Works Council, the members elect these people, and ultimately seven Works Council, they go to the Global Works Council meeting, much like the Republic, how we have electoral votes.
Wow.
They go to the Global Works Council every year, and they elect members of their pool to sit on our board of directors. They stay on that. They are equal with the rest of the board of directors. They elect seven of them. Okay, this is the only company anywhere in America that I know of that would even dream of openly offering its employees a chance to vote.
Oh, yeah.
To vote a man in, to sit on a council like this, and to help place people on their board of directors.
Yeah,
yes, this is an innovative new model, and it still has to be, the details have to be hammered out. But we are wanting to design our model based upon, we want to copy the German system.
Right.
As much as is legal under American law, we want to copy it here because it's a system that Volkswagen has proven works. I mean, you got to figure Volkswagen is a good 30 to 40 years younger than our American car company, yet it has surpassed every one of our American car companies in profit,
you know,
with a 40-year disadvantage in age.
And I look at this, and, you know, what's interesting to me, you know, I've always said, and you know, one of my little phrase lines has always been, if you're not sitting at the table, you're probably on the menu. So what you're saying is, you know, you're actually going to get somebody, you're going to get a representative to sit in the smoke-filled back room with the fat cat sucking on the cigars, actually seated at the table with an opportunity to keep the rest of you guys off the menu. To me, that's the way to go forward. That's the direction that we should be looking at. And as I understand in Germany, maybe you will know more than I will about this, but in Germany, as I understand, companies of a certain size, and I forget the number of employees, but it's mandated by law that a certain number of worker representatives have to sit on their corporate boards, a law that I could never imagine ever passing here in the U.S.
Yes, you're correct about that law. If memory serves me correct, it is a company that employs 15 or more people, if memory serves me correct.
Wow.
Sir.
I thought it was going to be 100
Germany
or something, but 15, that's
very pro-life.
And, you know, maybe,
no, go ahead, sir. I'm sorry.
No, I mean, and maybe when you look at this, you know, maybe we don't end up, maybe if we have a society of people who feel empowered on the job, because I have this theory, Chris, that, you know, we've been beat up so long in the workplace, and we walked in with our heads down and just, you know, hey, gotta duck and cover, that in society, we do the same thing. We do the same thing in our politics. We do the same thing in our social life, so that we're just accustomed to not being like my grandparents' generation, who fought everything. They fought World War II. They came back, they fought the boss. They came back, they fought for a better future for their kids. They were fighters. I think this generation of workers has kind of gotten a little complacent and maybe really beaten down.
Yes, I agree with you on that. My grandfathers are the same age as your grandfathers, and I know what you're saying. And yes, I do see people have gone complacent in the workplace. They just accept it, oh, it is what it is. But who says it is what it is? Why do we have to accept the status quo? Why are we not look forward to a brighter future? America's best days are not behind us. It's ahead of us. America's best days are in our hands. It's our choice.
I'm with you.
And I am glad to see that we have a German company here that is standing up and showing our American companies how they can do it right and succeed.
Last two questions I've got for you. One, you know, the politicians, the Bo Watsons, the Senator Corkers, the Zach Womps, the rest of them who have stood up and, you know, and have been in opposition to you guys being able to determine your future. They're imposing their will upon you. Do you think the rest of the people of Tennessee see them being obstructive, or do you see them kind of siding with them as well? How do you feel the pulse of your region?
The pulse of my region, I know people who are Republicans that are sick by the way that these local Republicans are acting in this situation. I mean, well, these are the same guys that go around and accuse the UAW of being thugs. But look who's acting like thugs. These are the guys standing up and basically trying to blackmail Volkswagen. That is thuggish behavior.
Yeah, absolutely. So the election starts on Wednesday. It's going to run, as I understand, through Friday. What do you think the chances are?
I say the chances are great, sir. I do, and I'm a very reserved person when I give an opinion on something like this, but I believe the chances are great.
Well, I'm hoping for the best. I wish you, Chris Brown, nothing but the best moving forward, and all of your coworkers. I wish you the courage and the solidarity that I know this takes, and I appreciate you taking time for us.
And I thank you, sir, for allowing me on your radio program. And you have a great evening, and thank you for your support.
You too. Thanks, Chris Brown. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You know what America needs? More jobs, that's what. Not Walmart-style jobettes, but real jobs. Stable ones with a good salary and benefits. Union jobs, so workers have a say in what goes on. Jobs that have strong protections against discrimination. A job you can make a career. Do useful work, take pride in it, earn promotions, and be respected for what you do. Believe it or not, there is at least one place where such jobs still exist. But, and you really aren't going to believe this, those in charge are pushing like hell to eliminate them, turning positions that ought to be a model for American job growth into just another bunch of job ads. The place? Your local post office. Right-wing government haters in Congress, along with the corporate executives now sitting atop the U.S. Postal Service, claim that in order to save this icon of Americana, they must decimate it. These geniuses are privatizing the workforce, selling off the invaluable community facilities and shrinking services. Hello, the workers, facilities, and services are what make the post office iconic and give it such potential for even greater public use. Their latest ploy is a partnership with Staples, the big box office supply chain. In a pilot program, 82 Staples outlets have opened, quote, postal units to sell the most popular and most profitable mail products. Rather than being staffed by well-trained and knowledgeable postal workers, however,
The many POs will have an ever-changing crew of Staples' low-wage temporary sales clerks with weak performance standards and no public accountability. This is Jim Hightower saying, cheapening postal work might be good for a few profiteers like Staples, but it will diminish postal service, and it's exactly the wrong direction for America to be going. For info and action, go to APWU.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Today, back in labor history, a couple of interesting things caught my attention today as I was looking at the history of work here in the country. Today is the 77th anniversary of White Shirt Day, which is one of the UAW's little bits of tradition to commemorate the anniversary of the 1937 sit-down strike. That gave them bargaining rights that really created, I look at the sit-down strikes of that era as what created the middle class, what created this opportunity for blue-collar workers to have respect, to have some dignity, and to be able to make a reasonable living. And the White Shirt Day, this being the 77th anniversary of that sit-down strike, began in 1948, where the mission was, look, you know, we're not going to get our white shirt any dirtier than the boss gets his. And you know, one day a year, they've done it. And it's one of those things that, look, you know, it is about having that commonality that you're all in this together. You know, it's, it is what it is. Also today in history, Mother Jones, Mary Harris, was arrested leading a protest of conditions in the coal mines in West Virginia. She was 83 years old at the time of her arrest. The most dangerous woman in America at the time because she had the audacity, the unmitigated gall to say that workers should have rights. And, you know, I look at this and I go, you know, where's our Mother Harris today? Where's our Mother Jones today? Where's Mary at today? Also today in 1913, 15,000 rubber workers went on strike in Akron. 65,000 workers in Seattle went on a general strike in 1919, fighting for better wages, hours, and conditions 2 years after World War I's wage controls. And also on this day, the sanitation strike in Memphis, Tennessee began in search of union recognition and wage and safety concerns. As we all know, that was the time, you know, Martin Luther King was down there for the strike, and it was assassinated on April 4th. The year was 1968. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Right-wing anti-union Tennessee politicians are now threatening to withhold further incentives from the state for expansion of the VW Chattanooga plant if the workers there decide to join the UAW this week. The historic election will be held Wednesday through Friday. Republican State Senator Beau Watson said at a press conference that should the workers choose to go union, he believes any additional state incentives for expansion of the VW plant would have a hard time passing the Tennessee Senate. VW is neutral in this election, but outside right-wing groups are running an anti-union campaign in Chattanooga. Pro-union VW workers featured in a UAW video expressed excitement at the prospect of the VW plant going UAW. VW Chattanooga worker Justin King says that a German-style co-determination model with union-represented workers and management working together would be good for VW.
Volkswagen will be stronger when they come together with the UAW because that combines not only Volkswagen's history of working with labor, but it also adds in the UAW's experience of working in the U.S. market.
Tammy Flint can't wait to vote for the UAW.
I'm excited. I can't wait. I was in the union for 15 years in the UAW, so I know what stuff they bring to the table with them. And I think it'll be a great thing. I just can't wait for this to get started. I'm ready for it.
Ed Hunter says the UAW effort at VW has been a grassroots worker effort from the start.
It's been a grassroots effort from the beginning that we invited the UAW in to start this campaign and help us through this transition.
Tennessee Republican leaders say VW is supporting the UAW, so that's why they're threatening to withhold any future state incentives for VW expansion. VW announced in January it's investing $7 billion in the North American market over the next 5 years. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio delivered his State of the City speech on Monday. He touted policies he says will protect the poor, help lift more New York workers into the middle class, and encourage immigrants to participate in city life regardless of documented status. The mayor is launching a new city ID program to allow immigrants who have problems getting IDs to obtain one. De Blasio also repeated his desire to have affluent New Yorkers pay a bit more in taxes. De Blasio says he wants to restore a sense of economic justice for working people. He says the city must head down the path of trying to close the income inequality gap. The New York City Retail Workers Union, RWDSU, meanwhile, is supporting an ordinance introduced in the New York City Council that would make organizing unions at retailers easier. The bill would keep retail stores in developments that get city subsidies from fighting union organizing efforts. Unions, in turn, would agree not to picket those stores.
One of the objectives we have over the next couple months is to help folks understand some of the circumstances that lead folks to a life of poverty. It could just be one bad decision or one unfortunate circumstance that spirals to a life of poverty. And we hope to examine what those decisions are, what barriers are keeping folks in poverty, and helping to eliminate some of those barriers in the future for individuals and families across the state.
Sanity. You know, I remember Chairman Reed's little poverty tour where they run around the state pretending like they cared about the poor and the hungry and the homeless. I remember that. And I love that frame. Well, we're going to examine what that bad decision was. You know, like being born? That was a bad decision. We should have rethought that decision. Especially being born to someone who's poor. You know, like when I was a kid. I should have rethought that decision. I really should have. And if I were really put some more thought into it, things may have turned out a little differently. How insane is that? That's just ridiculous. Anyway, I go back to this story with Jackie Spirey, who, I give her the ultimate credit, saying, look, I'm going to spend the night in a homeless shelter. We're going to actually talk to the little people. I think it's important. I think it's a good start. But I know somebody who did this while running for vice president a couple years back for an entire month. Actually wrote a really great book out of it, which is why I've asked Pat LaMarche to come on and talk to us. Pat, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me. I'm glad you didn't rethink it. You're an important part of the world.
Yeah.
I'm glad you decided to go ahead and be born poor.
Well, I'm glad you think that, but, it was a rough path. But, what do you think of this? What do you take from Representative Spirey's night in the homeless shelter? Do you see it as, because I look at Chairman Reed, Republican Policy Committee chairman here in Pennsylvania's attempt to play poor as a prank more than anything. But I think Representative Spirey's a little different.
Yeah, I think first of all, hats off to her for doing it at all. I got to say, a night is a nice start. But she learned a lot. The articles I've read about what she's done, she learned a lot of things about homeless people. She learned that, oh, by the way, an awful lot, like 2 million of them are children. Department of Education says 1.2 million homeless school children. That doesn't count toddlers and babies. She learned that they have jobs. many of them have multiple jobs. She stayed with one family, one homeless family. Everybody in the family had a job, and they were working all these minimum wage jobs trying to save up a deposit so they could get an apartment. So she learned, I mean, you can learn an awful lot just by looking at the problem. The problem with only doing it for one night is I don't know if you get a handle on maybe what the solution could be. But that's okay. I literally bow to her willingness to do it. You know, I wish all of them did. In fact, I wish that until things were corrected, they had to trade places with the homeless people.
There you go. There you go.
Here, have my home until I fix your place.
Yeah, I tell you, you've walked a mile in someone else's shoes. And what's interesting to me is, you know, and Friday she did the homeless thing, but on Thursday she did a speech on the floor saying, you know, you've got all these Republicans who think they're heroes and crusaders for fighting against getting food stamps and benefits to poor people. Yet they off with all of this corporate welfare, all of this huge money with huge amounts of meals and all over the world and just all kind of just outrageous stuff.
Yeah. I'm always so frustrated when someone says they're angry that a homeless person has a cell phone. I mean, can you imagine the average woman, young woman, homeless young woman is raped within 11 days of becoming homeless.
Really?
So, yeah. 11 days.
Wow.
So I know. So who do I want to have a cell phone? The lobbyist that I just gave a big handout to? Because trust me, they've got cell phones with your tax dollars. Or the homeless person.
You mean the Obama phone?
Yeah. So I think it's important that you did it. I think I do get frustrated sometimes when I see people who say, I'm going to try living on food stamps for a month, or I'm going to try doing, you know, walking a mile in this guy's moccasins, or 10 feet in this guy's moccasins, and then come back and haven't really learned anything. And I'm thinking, okay, what that was they were trying to sucker punch somebody. They were trying to walk so that they could say, oh, yeah, I met him, and they're all drunk. Or, oh, yeah, I met him. And, I'll tell you what, I could go into a whole pile of houses and find him drunk. There are plenty of people who drink or use drugs that have homes.
Yeah.
What's the difference between the homeless and the people's homes is money.
Yeah.
It's whether or not, you know, and there are people with mental illness that have homes. And, you know, everybody ends up in every kind of situation depending on whether or not they have the resources to help themselves or they don't. And that's the end of the story.
And you're right. And, you know, when I used to do the Hungry and Homeless for the holiday events, we met a number of homeless people who, didn't fit the stereotypical molds that we've been sold, the frames that we've been sold. Just not at all.
I think it would be nice if she could. I mean, I'm glad she's doing this. I'm glad she's getting so much coverage. I mean, I'm glad that she's, you know, New York Times, everybody. They're all writing stories about this woman. And
as they should. They should.
Because she's shining a spotlight on. But I think it would be nice if she could shame a few of her colleagues into doing it. You know, it's making decisions about things like food stamps when you have no idea what the problem is. Making decisions about housing. I mean, one of the silliest decisions I've ever seen about housing is the decision that if you bring anyone into your home, if you have federally funded housing and you bring anyone into your home, you lose your housing.
That's
someone
dumb.
Sleeps in your house for more than two nights, you lose your housing. But what happens if your daughter gets sick and she's an adult? She can't come stay with you?
Yeah.
No, she can't. You'll lose your housing.
It's ridiculous.
How stupid is that?
Absolutely ridiculous. We got a call in line, too. Let's find out what this is all about. Hey, welcome to the program. What's on your mind? You there? I guess that didn't work.
Yeah.
Tried.
Sounds like they're trudging through the woods. Maybe they're homeless, too.
Well, no, I mean, and we'll pick that up a little bit later. But, you know, the reality is when I played homeless for 8 days a couple of times, it was just that. I mean, so when you say you want people to, you know, to do this stuff, at the end of the road, you're still not really experiencing. Yeah, you're the little bit of discomfort's there, but the reality is at the end of the trek, you know you're going home.
You know you're going home. It's not humiliating for you because you know you're doing a good thing. She was never humiliated. Hey, I'm a congresswoman. I'm going to come stay with you. You know, she's getting accolades and pats on the back. The average homeless person who finds himself homeless is absolutely mortified. They're humiliated. They lie to people about where they live. If they get a ride home from work, they point to a house where someone else lives and says, that's where I live. After they get dropped off, they walk home to the homeless shelter or to the park or to the woods or wherever they're staying, or to their parked car. You know, I mean, there's none of this humiliation when you play homeless. I didn't feel it either. The anger, which I did feel after you're homeless or playing homeless long enough, you do get angry.
Yeah.
You get angry at what you see. And so, but there's a lot of anger, and then there's incredible fear. And I felt some of that fear. I mean, every single shelter I was in were, there were concerns over tuberculosis. I mean, I didn't know what I was getting myself into. I didn't think, oh my God, you know, I'll probably catch something communicable. There, every single shelter had tuberculosis scares that I was in. If I had an option of living in the woods or living in a shelter in the United States, I would take the woods.
And that's what I've heard over and over again when we did the food drives. You know, that's what people are saying, hey, we'll sleep on the street. We'll find somewhere to crash in a gazebo or something. And, you know, people find little nooks. And, you know, what I think most people struggle with is they want to help. I think most people truly do want to help. But, you know, you see, the problem appears overwhelming. You see people on the street. You see so much of this. I don't know that people know what to do. How do you deal with some of this? I mean, because I'm of the mindset that as a society, we need to be making sure that there are places for people to go and opportunities for people to get the mental health treatment that they need, the drug and alcohol treatments that they need. But, you know, as an individual, it seems overwhelming, no?
Well, for this cost, the combined cost of the Iraq and the Afghanistan war, we could have eradicated poverty in the United States three times. Three times. We could have wiped out poverty for every man, woman, and child living in poverty. Three times. So what we have to do is shift our priorities. The other thing is, it is overwhelming. It is too big for one person to do. That's why we need a responsible and compassionate government that represents the needs of this new set of priorities. That's why government programs are the best solution. And then lastly, we need people, if they feel so motivated, who'd like to do a little mentoring, who'd like to you know, be a big brother or a big sister. That's one of the best organizations on the planet.
I agree.
You know, who want to help kids at the library, at the local school. If you contact your local school and you say, I'd like to volunteer and work with some of your homeless children, every single school has to have, by mandate, by law, a homeless liaison who knows who those homeless kids are. They can contact the parents. They can say, you know, we've got some volunteers who'd like to help you. They can find out if they can get permission, and then they can hook you up. So there are a lot of things you can do, And you can do big-scale things like getting off your couch when it's very frightening and going to these places and finding out what you can do, or you can do small-scale things. And it sounds small, but it's the biggest one probably, which is vote properly. Don't vote for somebody who thinks the military-industrial complex is more important than your fellow Americans. You know, just don't do it. Don't vote for somebody who thinks the minimum wage is adequate. Don't vote for them. Or, by the way, we should get rid of the minimum wage. You know, we have to have great wages. We have to have decent retirements. The homeless shelters are filling up with the elderly. Those people haven't been homeless all their lives because, chronically homeless people don't get old. The average age of a chronically homeless person's death is 46.
Wow. So let me ask you the last line of questioning then, because we hear the right wing in this country saying the war on poverty was an abysmal failure. We just took all this money and chucked it down a big hole because we did nothing. They claim that nothing over the past 50 years has been done to alleviate poverty. It was just a huge failure. Are they right?
Well, you know, the real problem is that we have all these people in Congress that clearly can't read. Because if they would read the New York Times article that came out last month about the war on poverty. When the war on poverty began, the poverty rate in the United States was 20%. The poverty rate at the beginning of 1980 was 10%. So from 1960 to 1980, or 1965 to 1980, we cut the number of people in poverty in half. In half. And it's now almost back up to 20% because of Ronald Reagan and all the other baloney, the lies about the welfare mom. But the New York Times did a study that said that if the war on poverty had never been waged, even with the losses we've had since 1980, the poverty level right now would be 32%.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's where we're heading.
All those guys have to do is learn to read.
I mean, that's where we're heading. I mean, the reality is that's the direction. As more jobs are being mechanized, as more jobs are being offshored, as more jobs are being lost, we're finding more people falling into that poverty and into that despair and ultimately, eventually, into homelessness and probably much worse.
Right. Homelessness has doubled in 5 years. Doubled. And it's remarkable, really, because what the saddest thing about this whole discussion is we've talked, it's your favorite quote about getting half the people to the other half, we've talked the average person into believing that the guy up the street who doesn't have anything, even though he's working his butt off, that he's the enemy.
Yeah.
He's the drag on the economy. He's the drag on the system. When it's not. It's that welfare cheat on Wall Street. It's that welfare cheat in the CEO of the coal companies that's you know, nailing the worker, that's making a ridiculous 400 times what the worker makes, that's killing the worker, you know? If they're taking the huge coal subsidies, and I don't mean to pick on coal, let's pick on the oil companies, let's pick on the insurance companies, or, you know, find a huge multinational corporation, and they own your government, and they're trying to convince you that the real problem is the slob that works at Walmart who can't afford a dentist.
And they're doing it masterfully, because so many people seem to be buying it. Pat, I appreciate you taking time for us, giving us a bit of your insight and your experience. Always great talking with you.
Wonderful. Thanks, Rick. Have a great day.
Thanks so much, Pat LaMartian. You listen to some of those numbers, and I got to be honest, just blows the mind. Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Thought-provoking, opinionated, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working-class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
You know what America needs? More jobs, that's what. Not Walmart-style jobettes, but real jobs, stable ones, with a good salary and benefits, union jobs, so workers have a say in what goes on, jobs that have strong protections against discrimination, a job you can make a career, do useful work, take pride in it, earn promotions, and be respected for what you do. Believe it or not, there is at least one place where such jobs still exist. And you really aren't going to believe this. Those in charge are pushing like hell to eliminate them, turning positions that ought to be a model for American job growth into just another bunch of job ads. The place? Your local post office. Right-wing government haters in Congress, along with the corporate executives now sitting atop the U.S. Postal Service, claim that in order to save this icon of Americana, they must decimate it. These geniuses are privatizing the workforce, selling off the invaluable community facilities and shrinking services. Hello, the workers, facilities, and services are what make the post office iconic and give it such potential for even greater public use. Their latest ploy is a partnership with Staples, the big box office supply chain. In a pilot program, 82 Staples outlets have opened, quote, postal units to sell the most popular and most profitable mail products. Rather than being staffed by well-trained and knowledgeable postal workers, however, the many POs will have an ever-changing crew of Staples' low-wage temporary sales clerks with weak performance standards and no public accountability. This is Jim Hightower saying, cheapening postal work might be good for a few profiteers like Staples, but it will diminish postal service, and it's exactly the wrong direction for America to be going. For info and action, go to apwu.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You know, I love this story over at Penn Live yesterday. I wanted to get to it yesterday, but it was one of those, you ran out of time, only so many hours in the program. And it just caught my attention that, back to that frame of, you know, there's so much that the right wing thinks they know. The Benghazi, Benghazi! Yet they don't seem to really know anything. And the other is about the Federal Reserve. Here in Harrisburg, evidently some guy decided that he was going to file what the judge called a frivolous lawsuit. I love those frivolous lawsuits. Because this Harrisburg man wanted to sue the Federal Reserve. And wanted them to be found guilty of committing decades-long robbery. Not robbery, but rubbery of $12 trillion against the American people. And he wanted to be paid a couple of million dollars, $7 million, just for like a finder's fee. Because he says that the Federal Reserve has been systematically stealing gold bullion. Gold bars from Fort Knox. In fact, he says that the Fed has been charging taxpayers 73 cents on every dollar that they've pilfered in gold. Now, the judge, you know, basically threw it out, claims that the guy was irrational and lacking any arguable basis in fact or law, but that didn't stop him. Didn't stop him at all. And, well, this is a guy who spelled Fort Knox. N-O-X-I-C. So there you go. Is what it is. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. We've got Andy on line one. How you doing tonight, Andy?
Fine, Rick. How about yourself?
I am chuckling, to be honest with you. A guy wants to sue the Federal Reserve because they're stealing $12 trillion in gold bars.
Well, I don't know how much did they steal. I guess that amounts to the money they put in to bring the economy back with Wall Street when you count the true dollars.
Yeah, well,
I think that was in Mother Jones, that it was an ex-Goldman Sachs director that now writes that came up with a $14 trillion that they threw into Wall Street, you know, most of it guaranteed.
Well, you know, anything to bail out our corporate titans, man.
Yeah. More they should get them for that, the gold.
I'm with you. So what's on your mind?
Hey, I heard you mention my congresswoman.
Yeah, I think she did a great thing.
Yeah, she gets elected with like 79% of the vote. Like in the district we're in, you could run almost anybody and put the Democratic name tag on them, they're going to get elected. But what bummed me out about her was she had a chance to really put kind of her money where her mouth is.
Right.
By voting for the progressive caucus budget, the back-to-work budget.
Yes.
Which would have created 7 million jobs. It would have reduced the defense budget by $278 billion, brought in $4.2 trillion in revenue, would have created six higher tax brackets above $250,000. Would have done the transaction tax to bring in about $350 billion from Wall Street annually. But she voted against it. And I could never get a reason for that because I'd like to see them create some jobs. I'd like to see 7 million jobs created in this country. But she voted against it.
Now that makes two
of us. So here she is doing this little deal here. And you had over 70 Democrats vote for it. If she didn't want it, she could at least abstain and not vote against it. But, I mean, there's no bona fides here to really doing stuff for working class people when you vote against the progressive caucus budget.
I'm with you. We talked about it out here on the program. It's something that we should have been pushing, and we want more progressive candidates. I'm just giving her credit for doing something that I think is a good step. Now, looking at a lot of the other stuff, I don't know her record intimately. She's your congressman. She good? She bad? What's the story?
Well, that budget, too, would have unemployment would have been extended. There would have been training programs. It would have been like $497 billion in school funding. So that was one thing. She's very good on the trade deal. She votes against all the trade deals. She votes with labor on that. But when it comes to NSA spying things and kind of foreign affairs stuff, she's no good. She always votes for the NDAA, always voted for the Patriot Act. So I've always not liked her NSA. But she's real good on the trade deals. She always votes against them. She seems to be in line with labor there. But she, for a district, when you get 79% of the vote, there's no competition. You'd think we'd have a real Democrat. Now, frankly, she's not. She's just not.
Yeah, well, that's sad to hear.
Mainly just goes along with the corporate Democrat.
But she's got an interesting history, if I remember right. The name, when I saw her name, something popped into my head. Wasn't she part of what was it, Jonestown or something?
Yes, you can't go through metal detectors without flagging them because she's still got bullets in her body.
Yeah,
she's very good at. Yeah, she almost was killed at Jonestown. I think she had 6 bullets in her or something like
that. Wow.
And she survived. And the congressman that she was the staffer for, I think his name was Leo Ryan, he died. That Jonestown deal, and she was running to the plane, I believe, when she got gunned down. So she's very, very good on gun control also. Very strong there.
She's
a millionaire, and she uses her own money. She'll put a couple $100,000 in when they do gun buybacks here. She'll use her own money because she has enough of her own money.
So what you're saying is she's a mixed bag. I mean, there's some really good stuff.
Yeah.
And not so much. Oh, all right. Well, again,
when it comes to NSA and surveillance, forget it. She goes along with the corporate thing.
That's because you don't want to look weak.
Trade, she's good, right? Progressive caucus stuff, she doesn't align with the progressive caucus. And like I said, for somebody that gets almost 80% of the vote, you'd think we could have, an Alan Grayson type of Democrat in this district, but we don't.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the update. I appreciate the information, man.
All right.
Always great talking
to
you, man.
Nice to hear her name, man. I learned something on your show, man.
There you go. Thanks so much, Andy. Appreciate it, man.
All right. You have a great evening.
You
bye-bye.
And, but, that's the thing, I think, with most Democrats, to be honest. It's a mixed bag. You've got some that are really good on certain issues, some not so good on other issues. On this, I'm going to give her credit. I'll give her credit for what she deserves, at least paying attention. There could be a lot more, and I think, as Andy pointed out, maybe if we had looked into some of the other stuff, maybe if you'd have pursued the progressive caucus's budget ideas, which I thought were fantastic, the Tobin tax or the transaction tax on Wall Street would have brought in, I think it was $350 billion, as Andy pointed out. And then you put that money into job creation. You put that money into job training. And for me, the other part of this, now that I've stepped back a little bit and start looking down the road, start thinking about what's the future going to look like, and how do we then move to that, that self-actualization phase, if you will, if you're talking about the Maslow hierarchy of need. How do you get to the top of that, to where we're not working 50, 60, 70 hours a week? Maybe we've got a society that works 30 hours a week, or a society that works 20 hours a week, and we spend more time on leisure, and we spend more time on actually learning. Maybe we continue education. Maybe we continue more things that keep us occupied and constructively. Just part of the thought. Anyway, I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. This is another Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Salvatore Collalore.
On Fox News' America's Newsroom, Fox contributor Karl Rove criticized Senator Rand Paul's recent attempts to smear possible presidential candidate Hillary Clinton in an interview with co-host Bill Hemmer.
Rand Paul is out there. He's banging on the Clintons every day. Now, what's his strategy?
Well, I'm not sure he has a strategy. I was intrigued the other day. Somebody said, why are you doing this? And he said, because people keep asking me about it. This can't be, I want to run for president. It's got to be about something bigger than that. And frankly, Rand Paul spending a lot of time talking about the mistakes of Bill Clinton does not look like a big agenda for the future of the country.
Rove's comments fly in the face of public statements made by RNC Chairman Reince Priebus during a recent appearance on MSNBC.
So, I mean, I think we're going to have a truckload of opposition research on Hillary Clinton, and some things may be old and some things might be new, but I think everything is at stake when you're talking about the leader of the free world.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show. I got a news for you.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. So the big news, I mean, lots of stuff going on today. Lots of amazing stories. Oh, my goodness. All the guys I hang out with, on the weekend, to do the basketball thing and all that. I'm expecting many of their heads to be exploding today, because all I kept hearing about for the last several months has been Benghazi, Benghazi, Benghazi. It's all about Benghazi. In fact, I've had hundreds of emails from people. It's Benghazi. We got to impeach Obama. Yeah, it turns out there's no real there. And, again, this is what we've been left with. Sad stuff. Let's find out what's going on in D.C. above and beyond the Benghazi, and the debt ceiling. What's going on? I've got Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
So Benghazi. Is this the end of it?
Benghazi. Well, they actually said that the White House was not, they didn't comprehend the security risk of all of this, and that they should have known and should have told the American people it was a terrorist attack. However, help would not have arrived in time to save the four people that died there.
Right. So the crystal ball should have been brought out for this, right?
Right. I mean, clearly they couldn't have done anything, and finally the Republicans have to admit that.
Now, is there anything in this report from the Republicans that that has been released by the House Armed Services Committee that says, the defunding of, all the sequester and all the austerity?
No, it's a Republican report. What do you expect?
Well, if they're going to go this far, they go, then you're going to let him off.
They had to go this far. They're not going to go take the next. They're not taking the next train, my friend.
They're not going. Okay.
They don't want to lose too many elections.
But, the right got everybody all riled up. And I'll tell you, I have hundreds of emails from people saying, this is the reason we impeach. This is the reason we impeach Obama. And I remember the whole truckers ride for the Constitution, the idiots who five or six of them drove around the White House one day. And all the people who called me from there said, this, never mind all of the things that are going on in the trucking industry. Never mind all of that. It's all about Benghazi, they told me. And, I asked the one guy if he could find it on a map, then I might agree with him.
That's a good one. I'm going to have to try that one.
He couldn't. And, look, if you got to at least know where it is if you're going to go after impeaching the president of the United States.
Right. Well, Obama's safe on this one, I think.
All right. So that's good. I understand the Congressman Elijah Cummings is saying that we've been defrauded about $1 billion by this security clearance firm. What's up with that?
Well, that's right. The security clearance firm was in charge of doing all of these security clearances. And he's the ranking member of the Darrell Issa's committee, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. And basically, Issa's been on the Democrats for every positive plus thing or negative thing, particularly Benghazi. And it turns out that this USIS, this company that was responsible for doing these background checks, would do a partial background check. And then they would charge the government for a full background check and they made something like $1 billion with a B dollars.
That's capitalism. I mean, that's the essence of capitalism.
But corruption is not.
It depends on which capitalism we're talking about. If you're talking about the one that you write down on a piece of paper and you draw up as your model in your ivory tower think tank, then you're right. But in the real world, this is what happens.
Well, that's true. But Elijah Cummings is a Democrat, and he just went completely nuts on this firm today.
As he should. I mean, you know, I drive a truck on the weekends, kind of a hobby thing now, but I did it for a living for a number of years. And in order to keep my CDL, my commercial driver's license, I had to go and you know, I railed on this last week because it infuriated me. I had to go and go through a submit myself for a terror risk assessment, which I'm not horribly against. Okay, if that's what we're going to do as a nation, fine. But I had to go to the UPS store to get fingerprinted. And that just threw me completely.
I didn't know the UPS store could do fingerprints.
Yes. Now the UPS store has now branched out into collecting my fingerprints and a lot of other people. And, you know, I look at this. Now I got a question. If this security clearance firm is not doing the background checks, you know, the $60 that I threw in to be so that I could be knighted as not a terrorist, which I'm not, according to some. Are they doing the full background check on me? Because I want to know. Look, I'd like to know if I'm a terrorist. I'd like someone to tell me.
Well, I've actually, when I was working in mental health, and even actually when I started Talk Radio News, I did have security firms come and ask me various questions about people. And they, I have to say, were quite thorough in those days. And that was 20 years ago or so. But they were very, very thorough in those days. It sounds like they're not very thorough now, and they don't look up arrest records and things like that they should.
They just Google.
Well, you can just Google and find a lot of it.
Well, I mean, basically all they did. Then you know, just quick name search. They're fine. Cha-ching. Because isn't that what
And that's how they took the money.
Isn't that how it is, though? I mean, and this is what happens when you have lax oversight. And, you know, I go back to, you know, as we were talking about with Benghazi, the sequester, all of the austerity, all of the budget cuts. Again, this to me is another symptom of that. If no one's standing guard, if no one's paying attention, there's no cop on the street corner, you're going to see people running the light.
Right.
And this is exactly.
That's true.
This is exactly what's going on. And are you surprised then that we've lost $1 billion with a B, nine zeros, to this firm that did what? Hey, yeah, this it's done. It's how it's done.
No, I'm not at all surprised because I think people will take advantage of the government whenever they can, and I think that first of all, why would anybody give one contract out for that much money to one firm? How about all the little guys that would be happy to do it? People that you and I know that if you gave them $100,000 and said do, you know, 50 background checks or 100 background checks or even 1,000 background checks, they would do it extremely well.
Yeah. Well, again, you know, it's in
but
our.
They'd be happy for the business.
Yeah. In our system, though, it's who you know and whose campaign coffers. And that's just my view. Maybe you don't agree, but it's whose campaign coffers.
No, I do agree, unfortunately.
Yeah. So the NSA, no spying agreement yet?
No. So essentially what happened today is during the press conference with the president of France, a French person, well, no, an American person first asked about the NSA and whether the Americans were going to essentially do the same agreement, a mutual no-spy agreement. And the president sort of moved around that by saying, well, you know, we've got to worry about terrorism and we're not interested in getting into the French's the people of France's personal information, the same stuff he said about the USA.
Right.
But again, we don't know what they're really willing to do and what they're willing to stop to.
You know, the thing that gets me is I have a lot of conversations with different people about this. And, you know, because we all carry around this wonderful little device that, you know, I truly believe they can flip on and listen and watch or do whatever they want, whenever they want. And it's an amazing tracking device. It's our entire life that we carry. We don't even have to be chipped anymore. We're voluntarily carrying and paying for it. You know, there's part of me that goes, Ellen, you know, if they're going to have this kind of surveillance capability, should they at least be paying us for it?
Ah, yes, absolutely. Wouldn't it be nice to have say, okay, well, we can follow you around your cell phone, so we're going to pay your cell phone cost every month.
Yeah, I mean, they're doing it anyway, so should they pay it anyhow?
But you know, that's a brilliant idea. You ought to write a column on that.
But, you know, I look at this, and, you know, I'm amazed at the number of people who don't really think about that, that it never enters into that little thing on top of their shoulders.
Well, you know, it's the old story, although apparently it's not true. The frog, you know, being heated up in the cook pot, we don't know what's happened until it's too late to jump out.
Yeah. So are we going to Mars with the French? Is that happening?
We are going to Mars with the French. They apparently signed an agreement on Monday saying they're willing to help us out.
All right. So
quest to Mars.
We can't agree not to spy on them, but at least we're going to go to Mars together.
That's right. We, as they say in French.
Just as long as it's not on me. The other big news, debt ceiling.
Actually, the debt ceiling
without a hostage situation. I am so depressed.
No, it actually happened tonight, of course, due to snow. And they passed it. They had 28 Republican votes. Two Democrats did not vote with them. The Senate will obviously be involved. And the debt ceiling will be done.
Is that what it takes? A major environmental disaster? Is that what it takes? A major, weather event to get something done? Do we need to have?
Well, they knew they had to get it done, and they wanted to get out of town, so they didn't have many options.
All right, so it's along the right. So that's good.
And as a Democrat I know who I was with tonight, who's a member of Congress, said they gave us exactly what we needed to pass it, and then the rest of the people could go home and said, I voted against.
Yeah, and enough rope to hang yourself, too, as well, so that they can hang you with it. And I understand the new Fed chair, Janet Yellen, was testifying
today. Yes, she talked about quantitative easing, which essentially is also buying up all those bonds, and she said that they are going to ease up on buying all those bonds, but they were going to do it depending on what was happening in the economy. That she was not happy with the last jobs report. And I will say this about Janet Yellen. Of all the Fed chairs we've had in the past, a lot of them have been worried about inflation, et cetera. Janet Yellen is worried about jobs.
Yes.
That's a very good piece of news.
And it's something I've been saying for years, that we need to go back to the other part of what the Fed is supposed to be doing, and that's promoting full employment. I understand holding down inflation to a certain extent, but also you've got to be promoting full employment. And the only thing I ever gave Alan Greenspan credit for was not pulling back when the Clinton economy was heating up, when he could have raised interest rates and slowed things down. He didn't, and he let unemployment drop down. I think it was like 4% at one point.
Yeah, Alan Greenspan was not a charter member of the Rick Smith Ellen Ratner Club.
No, but I give him credit for that one thing. Now, you go to derivatives and all the other stuff that he didn't believe in fraud, he said, and he thought that all of these complex financial tools couldn't be regulated. Basically what brought the nation to its knees because of his ideology.
No, that's true. I mean, in the balance, I'm not a Greenspan fan.
No, I'm not either. I never said I was. But the one thing I do give him credit for is that. But, you know, I was happy to see that she said that she expects a great deal of continuity at the beginning of her tenure. So that you're going to see things, you know, smoothly going right along. And I hope that to be the case.
Well, I hope you're right. And I think that would be great.
Yeah, I mean, I liked last week it popped up that, you know, while Bernanke and Greenspan and all of them were for Wall Street, she says she's going to be for Main Street. And that's nice to see.
We need somebody like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, especially when you look at the reality that, you know, and I'm not a Thomas Friedman fan either, but he wrote a column not too long ago that said half of the jobs that we have today currently that people are doing in 20 years will be gone. They'll all be mechanized.
I think the other thing that really needs to be talked about is the fact that Ronald Reagan actually increased the number of people in the federal government.
Yeah.
If Obama were to be doing that, he'd be big government. When Ronald Reagan did it, well, he's not.
That's because we were taking down the Soviet Union. That was the only reason. that's what he gets credit for, right? He bankrupted the Soviet Union.
That's right. Mr. Gorbachev tore down this wall. Yeah.
And in the process, massive debt on our end as well. Good for that. But, you know, I look at this, and, you know, as you look down the road, we've got to be talking about what policy decisions are we going to make when there aren't enough jobs for people. Are we going to talk about, you know, having some type of supplemental income to make sure that people can participate in the economy? Are we going to talk about lowering hours or creating jobs through government? I mean, there's a lot of stuff that has to be addressed in the future as I see it.
I see it that way, too. You've got a crazy part of Congress that does not want to negotiate. The Tea Party, they thought they were sent there by their districts to be obstreperous, and that's what they did.
Yeah, it's well... So any good news on the Chris Christie front? Because he's still the 2016 front runner.
Do not think he's running. A lot of Republicans think they're going to put up Jeb Bush or even Ted Cruz.
Really, Ted Cruz? That would be fantastic.
That's what they think.
Jeb Bush scares
me. They're even making noise about Romney running again.
All right. Well, I don't mind Romney running again. Jeb Bush scares me because I think we're lulled into that Bush frame. And the other one that scares me is the younger Bush, George Prescott Bush.
He's not going anywhere. Don't worry about him.
Good. All right. Good. I'm happy to hear that. And so, so finally, nothing. What's going on with Christie? I understand his lawyers are asking for a meeting with the mayor of the town that got all blocked up.
Yes, I have not really, I'll tell you, I've not followed the legal battle on that. I've only followed the political battle. And a lot of the Democrats are saying he's completely done. I'm not so sure he is, but they think that he is done with his party. So we'll see.
The only thing I can see that he would be done on is if they can tie it all back to, some redevelopment plan or the Sandy money. And then some of the people I've talked to in Jersey, it seems Bush League for someone like Christie. To do something that stupid. Not all depends on what the mouthpieces who are pleading the fifth now, if they come out with anything. But I don't know. I just don't see that.
They're going to have to be some major deals made if they start talking.
Yeah. Well, we shall see. Ellen, always great talking with you. I appreciate the
time. Thank you.
Our good friend Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the talk.
For and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
You know what America needs? More jobs, that's what. Not Walmart-style jobettes, but real jobs, stable ones, with a good salary and benefits. Union jobs, so workers have a say in what goes on. Jobs that have strong protections against discrimination. A job you can make a career. Do useful work, take pride in it, earn promotions, and be respected for what you do. Believe it or not, there is at least one place where such jobs still exist. But, and you really aren't going to believe this, those in charge are pushing like hell to eliminate them, turning positions that ought to be a model for American job growth into just another bunch of jobettes. The place? Your local post office. Right-wing government haters in Congress, along with the corporate executives now sitting atop the U.S. Postal Service, claim that in order to save this icon of Americana, they must decimate it. These geniuses are privatizing the workforce, selling off the invaluable community facilities and shrinking services. Hello, the workers, facilities, and services are what make the post office iconic and give it such potential for even greater public use. Their latest ploy is a partnership with Staples, the big box office supply chain. In a pilot program, 82 Staples outlets have opened, quote, postal units to sell the most popular and most profitable mail products. Rather than being staffed by well-trained and knowledgeable postal workers, however, the mini POs will have an ever-changing crew of Staples' low-wage temporary sales clerks with weak performance standards and no public accountability.
This is Jim Hightower saying, cheapening postal work might be good for a few profiteers like Staples, but it will diminish postal service, and it's exactly the wrong direction for America to be going. For info and action, go to APWU.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again. Because God is a Republican.
Yes, God is a Republican.
Yeah.
He hates pregnant women. Hates pregnant women. Or at least single women who are pregnant. And, well, that's what the diocese in the great state of Montana said when they fired a Catholic school teacher who was, by all accounts, all stories, an excellent teacher. Excellent reviews year after year, but she got pregnant, had a little belly, a little bump. Decided going to have the baby. Yes, and you would think, hey, we celebrate that. No. She was single and she was pregnant. She had to be fired. And you know, I look at this and I go, well, hold on a second. Walk me through this. And I remember this as a kid growing up, because I had a seventh grade teacher, Sister Mary St. Ellen, who, right around Christmas time, went off to print Bibles at the mission. Up until Christmas, was getting a little thick around the middle. In retrospect,